Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Oh, my God, this is beautiful.
Kathy Phipps signed a lease on a house that means a lease on a new life.
Oh, bless your soul.
She's moving into a community that's embracing her with open arms. When we first met Kathy, she was a hurricane evacuee, surprised to find herself in Utah.
Utah?
But NBA, they had to put out a fire a little bit in Utah last night. That fire was Russell Westbrook, who we know is always combustible, no question about it, at all times. But they caught him on tape last night. We're taping this on a Tuesday. Today's Tuesday, so this was Monday night. Russell Westbrook and the OKC Thunder were playing at Utah, and they catch Russell Westbrook on camera arguing with a fan, and he was very volatile. Mm-hmm. Said some things
The LA came out.
He said he was telling the guy, "I'll F you up and your wife."
Oh.
So that caught a lot of people's attention.
Especially your wife.
A little extra. And, so he was caught on tape doing that. And then after the game in which they won, he explained himself and said, well, you know, the guy I was arguing with was yelling and screaming at me. And he told me to get on my knees like I'm supposed to be. And I took it as racial. And, you know, I don't feel like players should have to stand for this anymore. You know, we go into opposing arenas and they can just scream on us and demean us and blah, blah, blah. It's not right. The NBA should do something. And then a lot of most of the media on Twitter, NBA media, pretty much took his side on that. Mm-hmm. And we're like, you know, that's true. We know we've seen Russell Westbrook go through this kind of stuff. We see a lot of players go through this, fans thinking they can say anything to anybody because they bought a ticket.
And it's not the first time in Utah, in Salt Lake City, that Russell's had incidents with the Utah Jazz fans, and they're notorious for their disrespect.
Right. So, that's an issue we talk about on this program a lot in terms of the fan dynamic, the mostly white crowd and, you know, fans and how they deal with a mostly black product on the court. So while maybe that comment that he, you know, stay on your knees comment may not seem racial in itself, I think probably what he meant was just the racial dynamic of having white fans yell kind of demeaning stuff at him in general. That's the way I took it, at least.
Yeah, like to get on your knees like a slave,
or whatever
thing.
You know what I'm saying? Who knows?
Mm-hmm. But. And Russell also said, before we have Bill give his wisdom and insight on the situation, Russell also said as well, on everything I love, I'll F you up. Everything I love. I mean, he was pretty much saying, I'll risk everything. But and it could have been a malice in the palace once again.
Seriously.
This time with his knees taped up, he's like, iced up.
our test would have definitely ran up in the stands.
Oh,
no question,
Lord,
about it.
Yes.
But you know, so I mean,
we have a different kind of conversation.
Oh my
God. All of us have been around this stuff. We've been in these stadiums and arenas, and you know, we've covered the U.S. Open, for example, in tennis.
Right.
And it's like, it's not even tolerated. And the U.S. Open, golf.
Good point.
You know, golf is sports, which are the least integrated or the most homogenous, you know, is very polite, very kind. You wouldn't dare say anything. No heckling, none of this stuff. In the blood sports, you know, football, basketball, baseball to an extent. You know, remember, what was it, 2 years ago when Adam Jones was harassed?
Right.
In Boston?
Yeah, baseball's right there.
Baseball's right there. So I think that this is probably a tipping point. And this is really, it's the NBA, but I think it's stadium management. Because a lot of times we see security just sitting right there, not saying anything.
Right.
You know, I was talking to somebody, what is crossing the line? And I think this summer maybe you could have a panel of players, you know, from the NBA Players Association, some people from the stadium management, some people in the NBA, and kind of get a new rule code of conduct. That what does your ticket allow you to say, and what role should stadium management and security play in enforcing level of decency? And Westbrook's case, but what happens if you're sitting up in the stands and let's say, you know, Jamal, you bring your two sons. Well, you can be up in a football game. There's only so much, you know, vulgarity and that kind of stuff you want to be, you know, exposed to as well.
Right.
And your team, the Jets, fans are famous for that. You know.
That's true.
Yeah, and just to update the fan, his name is Shane Kazel or Kaisel,
whatever
how you pronounce his name, who has been known for racial tweets and the MAGA support and everything.
Wait, MAGA and racial tweet? I'm shocked.
All right, the combination.
Get out of here, man.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm so shocked. I'm so shocked he had a problem with Russell Westbrook. You
know? It's as shocking as the Suns defeating the Warriors.
That was shocking. You know?
but he's been banned for life. He's been banned for life from the arena, from the Jazz arena. And also, too, another thing, Russell was fined $25,000, which...
Yeah, I also want to point out Donovan Mitchell and some other players, but Donovan Mitchell from...
And Rudy Gobert.
And Rudy Gobert from the Utah Jazz. They put out statements, you know, saying that they were basically on Russell Westbrook's side, and they felt that something had to be done about fan behavior, especially in their arena, and that they had heard it before. So, you know, those two stepped up. You know, almost like Keith Bullock was saying earlier, the NBA is kind of like, you know, they're not afraid to speak out. They do stand together in most cases, and those two stepped up here. So, you know, I mean, you know, but the funny thing is, you talk about, you know, fans should be kicked out for, you know, making, you know, obscene statements and all that kind of stuff. What do you think, Bill?
Yeah. Well, I just think that, I mean, and then everybody, see, here's the problem, too, that you guys, that a lot of players like that stuff. You know, I mean, you know, Russell's a different, you know, everybody's got a different temperament, you know. But a lot of players like that stuff. You know, they like the sort of repartee with fans and the teasing that goes back and forth and the, you know, getting back. So, again, I think we just have to talk about where is the new line?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's crossing the line? You know, had Westbrook not fed into that, you know, it's like throwing logs on a fire. Had he not fed into that, maybe it would have been diffused. And then maybe you go over to the an usher, or you go to security, or somebody say, listen, you got to do something about this guy quietly.
Right.
You know, and then if security says we can't do that, now that's another issue. And then I think that's when it becomes an NBA, you know, because I think Adam Silver would probably, you know, you have a discussion about the each stadium. Says, listen, we're ramping it up a little bit, you know, that you got to really crack down on on decency.
Right, I agree, and I think, you know, based on past actions, I think Adam Silver probably does that. I think we'll probably see some sort of NBA response to this, or, you know, some change in decorum and what fans are allowed to do. I definitely see that happening.
And there's a meme, not a meme, but it is sort of a meme with Westbrook in Philadelphia, that fan that put both his middle fingers up towards Westbrook, and Westbrook was looking at the ref, pointing at the fan like, are you going to take him out? Kind of like that reaction. Obviously, probably Russ was in a better mood
right
at that time, but... you know, that's how you got to kind of handle them.
Right. And when we know, and also, you know, let's be honest. I mean, Westbrook is, you know, I mean, he's not the calm, you know, let me think this through type of guy, mm-hmm. you know, he doesn't play like that and that's not his personality. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you know, I would say you're right. The fans have figured out a way to get under his skin at the same time. And, you know, so, you know, he deserves some, I guess, blame, if you want to call it that, for, you know, for these type of situations. But all in all, I'm going to be on it. When it comes between Russell Westbrook and MAGA,
oh,
I'm going to roll with Russell.
Oh, 1,000 infinite percent.
once you have the MAGA hat, I ain't listening to you. You can't tell me anything. I'm sorry.
And remember, Russell, this maybe last month or earlier this month, there was a kid. He kind of went off. I mean,
a couple weeks ago.
There was his father. Remember, and the kid reached out like to touch him.
Right.
And Russell like complained about that.
Yeah, know? He went to the father like control your kid.
Oh yeah.
At least he didn't go for the kid. He didn't go for the kid.
No,
he went for the father. He was like, control your kid. You know, teach your kid not to touch people he's not supposed to, which is hard to argue.
Right.
California is the first state in the nation to track racial profiling complaints against police. But the latest result has been surprising. There were just 10 sustained complaints for 2017, the most recent year studied. Almost 650 other complaints were dismissed for reasons like insufficient evidence. That's created a lot of skepticism among police watchdogs and even officers themselves. For more, Associated Press reporter Don Thompson joins us now. Welcome, Don.
Glad to be here.
Don, these numbers were crunched by the very official-sounding California Racial and Identity Profiling Advisory Board, and it's all because of a 2015 law. How did this particular group collect the data?
So it's collected. It's submitted by law enforcement themselves and to the board through a Department of Justice, and then they compile it into a year-end report. And that's some of the numbers that you are reading there. They also have a number of their recommendations for how they think the local departments or agencies should do things better.
And you talked with several people about this data that's been collected. They've been very critical of the police, and not surprisingly, they are not pleased with this report. Tell us more about who these folks are that you talked to and what they said to you.
Well, there's a number of individuals who, with NAACP, with Black Lives Matter, who feel that there's actually, they're hedging on the numbers to try to keep criticism down. There may be, as notable at least, there's experts themselves within law enforcement, for instance, within Sacramento Police Department, who acknowledge that the numbers they have, that they provided, are low, that they're not they didn't include, for instance, informal inquiries. They only include the formal complaints, so that the numbers are somewhat, depending how you look at it, artificially low. Sacramento PD is expecting to try to change things so that they say will more accurately reflect the numbers. We also have a use of force expert. He's also a Plumas County Sheriff's deputy, and he says as well that those numbers are really unrealistic. He teaches use of force and other things along that line to police officers and deputies statewide, and he's among those that say these. He doesn't feel there's anything nefarious here, but says the numbers literally don't add up.
Right. So these are law enforcement officers saying this about these numbers. Were there any current officers or other members of law enforcement that actually stood by the report's findings?
Yeah, the Sheriff Dave Robinson and then Police Chief Swing represent the law enforcement, their agencies, the Sheriff's Association, the Chiefs Association, on the what's called the RIPA board, the Racial and Identity Profiling Act board. And they feel that the numbers are accurately reflecting that there are very few, in their view, racial profiling complaints statewide, and that there are very even fewer that are sustained. So in their view, it reflects that this is not you know, you don't have a lot of racist officers, and that this is a legitimate data.
Well, there sounds like there's some question about just the collection of the data itself and some of the issues around the reporting process. One of the issues, it seems, is whether a complaint lodged against a police or sheriff's department is formal or informal. Can you talk about why it makes a difference as to how a complaint is labeled?
Well, for instance, in Sacramento, the way they have been doing it is if it's a formal complaint, they, based on state law, take that to be one where an officer has the potential for being disciplined. And everything else pretty much is what they call informal inquiries. So it'd be, you know, where somebody just has a, you know, during his traffic stop, somebody was rude to me, or they didn't pay attention to what I'm doing, or, you know, whatever it happens to be. But if it's something where it's at a sort of a level where they're not alleging something like a felony or a misdemeanor, you know, took a bribe from me or something to that extent, it would be considered an informal inquiry and therefore would not be reported and would not show up in this this report.
And this data, in the long run, what is it supposed to be used for? Is it just something for, you know, departments to look at and reflect upon and see how they can improve their numbers? But, or is there some other, you know, bigger plan?
Yeah, the overall goal of the, as you can tell by the name, is to try to stop racial profiling or identity profiling, which is most of it, about 75% of the complaints that are out there are for racial profiling, but it can also be things like gender, age, disability, things along that line. But the big focus has been on racial profiling, and beyond this, which is based on complaints, the eight largest departments, and in coming years, the other departments are collecting data on every traffic stop. So they're going to be collecting, you know, age, gender, perceived gender identity, race, that kind of thing. And that is going to be coming out. We'll have the first data on that from the eight largest departments this coming January. And the overall goal here is to try to set, you know, get some idea of how often this is happening and to make sure it happens less.
But given the fact that there's so many folks who are incredulous about the numbers, is there any talk about maybe revising how the data is collected or how incidents are labeled?
Yeah, so there are a number of recommendations from the board, and that in the view of some who think that these are way too low, you know, once you make those, if enough departments collect or change the way they're collecting it so that they are getting including additional complaints, then that would drive the numbers up. But it's allowing things like anonymous or third party complaints. It's having watchdogs outside the department that would be able to see if they are in fact valid, as opposed to letting the departments themselves do it, or as one person put it, having these outside overseers have some teeth to make those decisions. So there's a number of recommendations in the report that, if they're voluntary recommendations, but if a number of departments accepted them, then the speculation, at least, is that that would have an increase in the numbers as a result.
All right. Don Thompson, he is a reporter for the Associated Press. Thank you so much for talking to us about this racial profiling data.
My pleasure.
Black babies cost less.
I want to share my experience with someone. I don't want them to forget about Aubrey and Abe. I want people to say their names.
Tasha Smith lives in Cleveland, Ohio, and that experience she's referring to is losing her twin newborns.
I called the doctor. The doctor said, don't panic, but come in immediately. Minutes into getting hooked up to the machines and everything, I was alerted that Aubrey's heartbeat was no longer beating.
Tasha had to deliver Aubrey and Abe at 23 weeks. Abe died just days after birth. Aubrey was stillborn.
And they asked me, did I want to see Aubrey? Of course I wanted to see Aubrey because I wanted to see what she looked like. So they brought me Aubrey, and it was the hardest thing to see. She was beautiful. Most beautifulest little girl you could ever see, just looked like she was sleeping. Strong features to be 1 pound and 4 ounces.
In 2017, there were more than 850 known stillbirths here in Ohio. So Tasha's not alone in the experience. But the racial divide is staggering. Twice as many black babies are stillborn as white in Ohio. According to the CDC, national numbers are similar. And yet, as racial discrepancies in infant mortality overall get more national attention, it's something we've covered quite a bit on this show, stillbirths are less often discussed. But talking about it may be just what's needed to ease that specific trauma that women like Tasha go through. Anne Glosser is managing producer of health and education for WCPN Cleveland, and she's been reporting on this. Anne, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The clips that we just heard are really powerful and painful. What started you on this reporting line?
Well, I was speaking with a chaplain from our local hospital system, and he mentioned that, you know, a lot of women go through the stillbirth process alone because, you know, you still have to deliver the baby. And so that got me started thinking, what's this experience like, right? And so then I dug into the data a little bit and really found that the stillbirth numbers are on par with the infant mortality rate, which, you know, we hear an infant mortality rate, that is all the babies that die within the first year of life but are born alive, right? So it does not include stillbirth deaths. So the numbers of stillbirths were very significant. And we hear a lot about the infant mortality numbers, but not a lot about the stillbirth numbers. So I really wanted to dig in and talk about that.
And remind us again the difference, what a stillbirth is.
So a stillbirth is when a baby dies in utero, right? And when a baby dies within their first year of life, that's considered infant mortality, but they need to be born alive to be counted in that statistic.
Now, again, we know that there are discrepancies in race in terms of infant mortality. Black babies have a higher likelihood of dying than white babies do. But what is driving the stillbirth discrepancy here?
Well, we're not sure. And again, you know, as with infant mortality, we know that the racial disparity cuts across all socioeconomic factors, right? And so researchers are pointing to this idea of toxic stress, and they're still trying to grapple with what's going on here in our infant mortality numbers. And what we know is that, at least here locally, preterm births are really driving that infant mortality rate, and that's definitely associated with stillbirth figures as well. So we think that there's some speculation that there might be something to do with the stress that's going on there in women's lives.
And you also spoke to experts about specific trauma that this can have, the impact that this can have on mothers. Let's hear from one of the grief counselors you spoke to.
Some moms develop what we call post-traumatic stress syndrome because they've all of this different things that's going on. They actually, you know, see their baby dead, a lot of blood and different stuff. So they have flashbacks and they try to avoid even thinking about the baby.
Is that what you heard from other mothers, Anne?
We did hear this from a lot of women that we worked with for a bigger series that we were working on about trauma and loss within the African American community here in Cleveland. And it's really a profound experience, right? One of the folks I spoke with for this story called it such a deep experience that sometimes women don't have words to describe it. And it's something that a lot of times it creates this grief that's just not acknowledged by society because, you know, you're supposed to come home with a baby and then you don't, and then people don't know how to talk with you about it, and you're sort of just supposed to get over it. And it's not like when your grandma dies or something and that's openly acknowledged and discussed and, you know, you're supported by your social networks. There's something different, at least according to the people that I was talking with for this story, about the stillbirth experience, because society doesn't like to talk about dead babies.
Let's talk a little bit about what is being done, if anything, to help mothers like Tasha.
So Ohio did create a partnership with this nonprofit organization called Count the Kicks that made patient education materials available to health professionals and did a lot of outreach there. The idea there being that encouraging mothers, pregnant mothers, to count the kicks, count the number of times their baby kicks, and the idea being that if the kick count goes lower, that you could, that would signal trouble and you could go and get into the hospital earlier and maybe help prevent a stillbirth. But the evidence there is a little mixed on whether that's effective. A 2015 Cochrane review found that it didn't help. And recently, the new governor of Ohio has an increased focus on home visits for pregnant women and new mothers. And this is, you know, an evidence-based way to decrease infant mortality, which may have some effect on stillbirths. And also there's, you know, some smoking cessation programs and chronic disease management programs and family planning and pregnancy spacing initiatives, because if you space out your pregnancies a little bit further, then your body has more time to recover and better chance of having a healthier pregnancy.
You mentioned earlier that people don't like talking about, in your words, dead babies. Why is that? What is there a cultural issue here? Is this a piece of our just general social fabric that makes us uncomfortable? What is happening where we don't talk about this enough?
One thing that we encountered a lot with this series that we were doing was trying to look at this taboo and examine it and see whether it is helpful for us. Because what we heard a lot from the community is that for women who are ready to speak about their loss experience, that it can be healing.
Ann Glosser is a reporter and managing producer of health and education for WCPN Cleveland. Ann, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
As your body grows bigger,
your mind must flower. It's great to learn,
because knowledge is power.
Your schoolhouse rocking, the chip off the block on your favorite schoolhouse rock.
So the inescapable story this week has been the criminal charges against 50 people, including business leaders, celebrities, and athletic coaches, all having to do with wealthy parents trying to buy their kids' way into elite, and sometimes not so elite, U.S. colleges. So let's talk about it. And not so much this crime and the juicy details of fake photos and of athletic prowess and cheating on the SAT and the ACT directly, but what it exposes about the inequities of American education systemically, from legal means of buying your kids' way into a good college to the more systemic issues around how education is funded, starting as early as pre-K. And for this, I'm joined by three guests. Autumn Arnett, author of a book called Let's Stop Calling It an Achievement Gap. Ed Boland, former executive at Prep for Prep, which offers promising students of color here in New York a private school experience. He's also a former admissions officer at Fordham and at Yale, and the author of The Battle for Room 314, an account of a year he spent teaching at a public school on the Lower East Side. And Libby Nelson, news editor at Vox and a former education reporter there. Welcome back, Libby Nelson, and welcome Ed Boland and Autumn Arnett.
Thank you, Brian. Pleasure to be here.
And
thank you.
And listeners, our phones are open. Parents, teachers, students, admissions officers, coaches, have this conversation. Has the scandal made you question any of your assumptions about what it takes to get into a good college legally and legitimately and the costs to your families or society? 212-433-WNYC. If you want to chime in from your personal experience, 212-433-9692. Libby Nelson, you wrote about this and pointed out in boldface type on Vox, the scheme only worked because college admissions in America is broken. Broken how?
Well, the way that this scheme worked in some, not all cases, was essentially faking athletic records so that students could get into college under the lower academic standards that colleges typically have for athletes. Obviously, that only works because colleges have lower academic standards for athletes to be admitted. And why do they do that? They do that not because it can be a great part of your education to play, you know, tennis or swim or play basketball, although that may be true, but because having competitive teams is good for that college. It's good for their branding, and so they want to be able to attract those students. If we didn't have that influence in higher education to begin with, if colleges were thinking, you know, just about what is the best educational environment for our students, it wouldn't matter if you had a fake athletic record or a real athletic record. It wouldn't work.
Ed Boland, you worked in admissions at Fordham and at Yale. How much of what could be called affirmative action for the wealthy did you see in either case?
You know, and it's strange to say, but I'm glad this crisis broke, because I think it is really going to throw into stark contrast the disparities between the haves and have-nots, which I saw in my time in admissions offices and also at Prep for Prep, and just in my teaching experience as well. You know, so much relies on the kind of school, high school a student attends, and the disparities in our country are so great. You know, let's look at the public school where I taught, which didn't have a library, versus some of the preparatory schools that are sending kids to colleges where they have planetariums and golf courses and ski hills and are offering 10 languages. And, you know, it's a $50,000 bill. They're trying to diversify. They offer scholarships. But the disparities at the educational school level are great. But also outside the classroom, the test prep, the tutoring that goes on for every single subject, tutoring that goes on for sports. There's a disparity at every level.
All those systemic things. Did anyone ever try to bribe you?
No.
What's the most outrageous?
It would be hard to do. Yeah. It would be very hard to do because, of course, it's not a singular decision on your part. There's always a committee. There's a committee in place in
right.
all these
Fair
institutions.
Enough. Any story, though, of some kind of outrageous overreach by an applicant's family or a paid advocate for the applicant's family?
Yeah, I do remember a family, you know, this is before DNA testing, you know, going back to try and find Native American roots, which was absolutely absurd. And they even tried to prove it. It was ridiculous the extent they went to try and get in the Native American category. And there was no validity to it whatsoever.
Autumn Arnett, in your book, you focus more on public elementary and high school systemic funding and how that results in huge differences in educational opportunities between rich and poor, and often between white and black and Latino kids. So this doesn't just start with SAT test prep and essay coaching. What did you find centrally in terms of the disparity and how it happens?
Right. So what I found was around the country, you find resources being very heavily clustered, right? So in Birmingham, for example, a neighborhood can break off and form its own school district if it just doesn't want to be a part of the district that the Birmingham City District. So you find the hypersegregation, but you also find that often regardless of income, right? We usually like to say that black and brown children are poorer and that's why they don't have access to resources, but often regardless of income, you find students of color put in schools that have lower access to AP scores, fewer school counselors. So to the point about just some of these resources way before SAT prep, you have the issue of, there are parents around the country who are in jail for using a grandmother's address to get their student into another school. There's a preacher in L.A. who years ago was jailed for trying to teach parents to file their children as independent so that they would get more aid. There are people who are trying to, and by the way, students who would be on their own anyway, right? Students whose parents don't have money to contribute. Mm-hmm. There are so many families who are in jail for trying to get their students access to a better K-12 education so that they could rightfully earn their spot at these colleges, you know, so that they could have the option to take AP courses and excel in them.
What do you mean they're in jail for that?
They are in jail for that. It's an actual crime to use someone else's address to get your child into a different school other than the one that you specifically are zoned for.
Ed Boland, you're smiling. Is that the glint of recognition?
I know the extent that people are willing to go to get their kids into better schools. And, you know, the fact that our whole system is predicated on funding schools and property taxes, people will cross, you know, any boundary to get their kids into a better school. And sometimes they pay the price. And that's really unfair.
Jane in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jane.
Hi. My daughter also just recently going through the admissions process, entering college in the fall. I've already apologized to her for not having $500,000 to buy, bribe, or cheat her way in, thankfully. So
at least you're apologetic about it to her.
I'm interested, though, when people – I'm concerned that people are saying qualified, and what they mean is only academically qualified. And I feel, having had a son that's gone through college, that the colleges want to have a college community that has a lot of different attributes, and it's not only about the academics. So I wonder what your guests think about college's discretion. Obviously, this is a crazy-ass situation, but – college's discretion to create a college community that's based on more than just a very narrow standard of quote-unquote academic achievement. And I'll hang up and take it off the air. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Jane. Libby Nelson from Vox, do you want to address that?
Yeah, this is something that comes up a lot in discussions around another type of admissions preference, which is affirmative action. And a thing a lot of people don't know about considering race in college admissions is that colleges can do that only to create a better educational environment for all students. It's not enough to try to help, you know, an individual student or to remedy a legacy of discrimination. And that speaks to the fact that colleges are trying to create an educational community where there are a variety of perspectives, a variety of abilities, but in ways that benefit all of the students there. So it might be your background, it might be where you're from, it might be something like, you know, this is somebody with a very strong musical talent. So there certainly are, and appropriately so, I think, a role for admissions officers to consider things beyond just, you know, what were their grades, what were their SAT scores, what will they add to the community. What we saw in the scandal, though, is not necessarily students who could make a case that they were dramatically different from others on campus or that they brought something that would really contribute and make up for the fact that they may not be, at first glance, the most academically prepared. And so when you have a system that values other things, you also see people trying to game not just the grades and the test scores, but those other qualifications. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we saw here, particularly in the athletics realm.
And Autumn Arnett, author of Let's Stop Calling It an Achievement Gap, do you want to add anything to that or react to our first two callers in any way?
Yeah, I was just going to add to what Libby was saying, to say that the system as a whole is more built on who you can let out or keep out rather than let in, right? So we talk about academic qualifications and having a standard and showing preparedness for college, but I think we've also seen studies that say SAT scores don't necessarily correlate to how well someone's going to do in college. I think to Libby's point about the entire system being broken, if we think that college is for everyone, which is kind of the idea that came out in the Obama administration, right, everyone should go to college, then we have to do a better job of changing our thinking behind that. You can't say college is for everyone, but not our college, right? You have to be a little bit more intentional about evaluating the criteria, or maybe you think that certain colleges are for everyone. Maybe some schools are to do something. You know, not every school is created to do the same thing. Not all schools even want to do the same thing. But I think we have to do a better job of having that conversation of, A, what is higher education intended to do? B, what is our value system in higher education? Is it exclusivity? Is it who doesn't get in? Is it being able to say? And I think there's a financial benefit to keeping it that way, right? You get more donors, if it's a more exclusive thing, you get more exclusive alumni, that's part of this problem too. You have more exclusive parents who can donate money and kind of help the school thrive that way. So we really have to unpack the entire system to figure out what is higher education created to do and who is it created to serve.
John in Hillsborough, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. As I understand it, there is a lawsuit in the lower courts of the Boston, Massachusetts area where some Asian American or Asian students are challenging the set-asides that Harvard has done for, I believe, women and minority students. And, of course, with the eventuality of that winding up in the Supreme Court, probably to challenge all of these types of set-asides. And I'm just wondering, in light of this scandal, doesn't that kind of blow the entire recruitment an admissions process out of the water, because now it looks like maybe people on the other side of the equation may not be qualified either, but at least they haven't been identified by racial or gender status. But they're, you know, like just because they're 1%ers, 2%ers, they may not be qualified, but they're getting in. So to me, it appears that you would have to evaluate the entire system now, especially if I'm going to defend Harvard, for example, in this case of for their recruitment of women and minorities, because now maybe we're looking at on the other end, well, maybe there are some people that are unqualified on that end. So if I'm an Asian student trying to challenge those set-asides, then maybe I need to challenge all set-asides, including those hidden ones that are finally coming out because of this scandal.
John, thank you very much. So on his point, Ed Boland, as a former admissions officer at Fordham and Yale, maybe one reason that we see people buying their kids' way into college in the way the scandal revealed is that there's a loss of faith in the equity of the system in many race and class groups right now.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think some of it is a reflection also of the increased competition over the years. You know, the numbers of applications at a lot of selective institutions have doubled. So it's bringing it into even greater pressure because of that. But, you know, I think you make a good point that we need to look at this. All these different segments are causing us to relook at the entire system. We haven't even mentioned legacy admissions. You know, let's look at the fact that children of Harvard alumni enjoy probably a 5% greater acceptance rate than non-children of alumni. And you know, at a place like Princeton, you're looking at, you know, recently 12% of the class was legacy admissions, 12% of the class was recruited athletes. That's, you know, 1 in 4 seats. So we need to – this is all these different categories. This is an opportunity to take a complete ground-up, holistic look at the system and eliminate a lot of these unhelpful – you know, is a college really a better place because it has children of alumni on it? Do we really need to be rubbing elbows with, you know, Olympic-level water polo players to make our collegiate experience better?
Autumn, you have a thought about the big picture there? I mean, you know, what John in Hillsborough kind of brings up is Asian parents feel discriminated against. White parents feel discriminated against by affirmative action. Black and Latino parents certainly feel discriminated against by all the systemic stuff in this country. And if there's no faith in the legitimacy of the system, well, then, you know, that breaks down some of the barriers to cheating.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people across the country have lost faith in higher education, and I don't think that it's necessarily based on this conversation. I think it's more of a workforce conversation that people are having. But I hesitate to go along with kind of lumping all of the groups together, because I think that there were very intentional laws in place that kept certain students out of schools. And again, this is from K-12 levels all the way up to higher education that didn't apply to others. So while I think that internal bias is absolutely a factor against, and it can be against any group or any belief, I think that the conversation has to be separated out, and we have to specifically talk about the things that were intentionally put in place to keep certain groups out versus needing to address bias as a whole on the other end.
This is my rifle. There are many like it, but this one is mine. My rifle is my best friend. It is my life.
I must master it as I must master my life. Without me, my rifle is useless. Without my rifle, I am useless.
I must fire my rifle true. I must shoot straighter than my enemy who is trying to kill me. I must shoot him before he shoots me. I will. Before God, I swear this creed. My rifle and myself are defenders of my country. We are the masters of our enemy. We are the saviors of my life. So be it, until there is no enemy, but peace. Amen.
White nationalism in the U.S. is becoming more visible and more deadly, from marchers in Charlottesville to a gunman at a Pittsburgh synagogue. In the new issue of The Atlantic, Adam Serwer looks at the American roots of this movement. He writes that what is judged extremist today was once the consensus of a powerful cadre of the American elite. Adam Serwer, well, welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you for having me.
If you had asked me to guess where white nationalism in America comes from, I think I might have said the Deep South, given its history of segregation, lynchings, slavery, etc. But you write that this movement actually had strong underpinnings in elite New Englanders in the early 20th century. Tell me about them.
That's right. So the essay focuses in large part on Madison Grant, who was a patrician New Yorker and conservationist who applied his experience with endangered animals to essentially white people in the United States. And what he warned was that the influx of immigrants that had been occurring over the past few decades was threatening democracy itself.
I'd never heard of this man, Madison Grant, but you say that he provided a kind of pseudo-scholarly backbone for a lot of racist ideas that were popular in the early 20th century. What function did he serve in this larger racist dialogue?
So I would say that Grant is, in the words of immigration scholar John Hingham, the most influential nativist in American history. And the reason is that he synthesizes what you might call race science, which is sort of a pseudoscience of proving that a particular group of white people are superior to everyone else on earth. And the United States was committing race suicide by allowing immigration of inferior genetic stock, by which he largely meant people of Italian descent, people of Eastern European and Jewish descent.
And at the time, were those views considered radical, extreme, fringe?
His book, The Passing of the Great Race, was actually extremely well received by the American elite. People like Theodore Roosevelt, President Harding, Calvin Coolidge. He was expressing the consensus of an elite group of white people that the country was being ruined by the influx of these immigrants who were of inferior genetic stock.
And you write that this book, The Passing of the Great Race, was actually cited by Hitler. Hitler called it his Bible. So explain how these white supremacist views came to be adopted by Germany and why, if these views were so widely accepted by American elites, the U.S. ultimately went to war to fight against those ideas.
Well, I wouldn't put all of the Nazis on Madison Grant, but I would say that he was influential in that American immigration law, which was profoundly shaped by Grant's theories, was influential on the Nazis. And Hitler in Mein Kampf goes at length saying things like America is the one country that has understood the importance of protecting its, you know, genetic purity.
This is not the story that we are told in American history books. You write about what you call historical amnesia about this chapter of history. How has it been rewritten and why?
Well, I would say that there were significant ideological distinctions between the Nazis and the most virulent American racists. The American South was actually quite anti-Nazi. And part of the reason for that was they believed in a white man's democracy, but they didn't actually want to live under a fascist regime. I think that this is a particularly painful chapter of American history because it undermines our national identity of being a place where anybody can become an American. But the truth is that the conflict over who should be considered truly American is something that is very old. And this particular chapter is one that most Americans, right and left, would rather not reflect on.
Do you see a direct through line from the kinds of things that Madison Grant was saying and writing about 100 years ago to what we hear in public discourse today?
I would say that the scholars of this era and of immigration who I spoke to said that there is absolutely a through line. The idea that the presence of immigrants of a particular type is threatening to the nature of American democracy is something that you can see pretty much every night on Fox News. You can hear it from the president when he talks about the danger of allowing Latin American people to come here. But in large part, Grant has been removed from popular memory, and so it's more difficult for us to understand exactly where this comes from.
Well, what do you think the lesson is that we should learn from this chapter of U.S. history 100 years ago?
We have to be extremely careful about disregarding the baseline American values that are, in my view, what make this country a wonderful place to be, which is that anybody can come here and be an American, and that we shouldn't define American citizenship on the basis of race and religion in the way that we once did.
Adam Serwer, thank you very much.
Thank you.
His essay, White Nationalism's Deep American Roots, is in the latest issue of The Atlantic.
This question, why is this stuff happening? The New York Times editorial today, the Trump effect. See, this is what I'm doing with my money, buying newspapers like Dick Gregory. the Trump effect and how it spreads. It says we are on the brink, under Trump, on the brink of fascism. New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, editorial 1210-2015. I say fascism is end-stage white supremacy. See, it's, I mean, just like in Nazi Germany. Fascism, system of racism, white supremacy, determined to survive.
New Zealand is a nation stricken tonight. A self-declared white supremacist gunned down Muslims at prayer today, striking terror into a country where police rarely carry guns. The massacre in the city of Christchurch left at least 49 people dead and another 48 wounded. Amna Nawaz begins our coverage.
It is the deadliest shooting in New Zealand's modern history. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern addressed the nation hours after the horror unfolded.
It is clear that this is one of New Zealand's darkest days.
Just before 2 p.m. local time, a gunman dressed in all black stormed the Al Noor Mosque in Christchurch, crowded with worshippers for Friday prayers.
We heard, you know, the firing, and then everybody just ran toward the back doors just to save themselves.
Mohammed Jama, former president of the mosque, saw the gunman enter the building.
And he have helmet, and he have given the glasses, and he's a dress of the military, and he's a gun, machine gun.
After 2 minutes, the gunman walked outside, shooting people on the sidewalk. He then went back into the mosque to continue shooting some of those already wounded. Ramzan Ali survived by hiding.
I just lay down under the bench and I'm thinking that, you know, if I get out, I'll get shot, so I'm just keeping my fingers crossed so I could be alive.
Within 2 hours, more worshippers killed in a second attack at Linwood Mosque, 3 miles away. The gunman live-streamed the attack on Facebook, apparently using a helmet camera. Facebook said later it had removed both the shooter's Facebook and Instagram accounts and taken down the video after the shooting and all posts supporting the attack. Police have charged one man with murder and detained two others for investigation. On social media, the apparent shooter identified himself as Brenton Tarrant, a 28-year-old Australian. He posted a 74-page manifesto calling himself an avowed racist and citing as inspiration both the white supremacist who killed 77 people in Norway in 2011 and the white supremacist who murdered 9 black parishioners at a Charleston, South Carolina church in 2015. He also mentioned President Donald Trump by name, calling him a, quote, symbol of renewed white identity. In Washington this afternoon, President Trump addressed the attack.
These sacred places of worship were turned into scenes of evil killing. You've all been seeing what went on. It's a horrible, horrible thing. I told the Prime Minister that the United States is with them all the way.
The massacre left New Zealand's small and close-knit Muslim community, around 50,000 people, reeling.
Family, friends that we've known for 19 years, dead. People who were there for my engagement, dead.
In neighbouring Australia, Prime Minister Scott Morrison denounced the attack.
We grieve. We are shocked. We're appalled. We are outraged. And we stand here and condemn absolutely the attack that occurred today by an extremist, right-wing, violent terrorist.
It is clear that this can now only be described as a terrorist attack.
The mass shooting, New Zealand's first in more than 20 years, prompted unequivocal condemnation from the Prime Minister.
There is no place in New Zealand for such acts of extreme and unprecedented violence, which is, it is clear this act was.
Tonight, police in New Zealand and around the world say they're ramping up security for mosques. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Amna Nawaz.
We explore the broader questions about the ideology behind this act of terror with Humaira Khan. She is the executive director of Muflehun. It's a nonprofit organization that works to prevent the spread of hate, extremism, and violence in the United States. Kathleen Belew is an assistant professor of history at the University of Chicago and has written extensively about white supremacy movements. And Matthew Knott, he's a reporter for the Sydney Morning Herald based in New York. Before moving to the United States, he covered Australian politics. And we welcome all three of you to the NewsHour. Matthew Knott, I'm going to start with you. This man moved to New Zealand from Australia just a few years ago. Tell us a little about the political climate in Australia right now.
Yes, it's absolutely devastating for people in Australia that this has happened, not just because we are so close with New Zealand. We consider ourselves two halves of the same whole, really. But the fact when it emerged that it was an Australian has really shocked and made people so upset in Australia that it was an Australian responsible. And it does reflect some of what has been happening in our politics in recent years. There has been a growth of anti-Islamic rhetoric. One of the parties that has held the balance of power in our parliament since our last election in 2016 is called One Nation. And one of its principal planks of its policies is a very strong critique of Islam. The leader of that party, whose name is Pauline Hanson, described Islam as a disease that needs to be vaccinated against. So this has been a big part of our political rhetoric over recent years. So it's very disappointing to see this playing out this way.
You were telling us that some of this thinking has become normalized in Australia.
Yes, that is the thing. This party, One Nation, came to the fore in the 90s, predominantly protesting against Asian immigration and against benefits for Indigenous Australians. And that was the party was basically stamped out of existence by the mainstream parties, who said that was not acceptable. And then it has come back to prominence in recent years with anti-Islam rhetoric, and that has proven more acceptable to the Australian public. After winning four seats in the Australian Senate, the government and the opposition both needed the votes of this party to get anything done. It has been normalized in our discourse.
Humaira Khan, you spent a lot of time looking at extremism like this. You've read this man's manifesto, what he called his manifesto today. What came through to you?
So I think there's a few things. One is that there's nothing particularly new in there, which we haven't seen in previous manifestos. So he's drawing on ideologies from a spectrum of right-wing groups, right? But you see the similarities of what has been repeated before. So you hear the stuff which is being used by the neo-Nazis, by the white supremacists. There's a variety of... So he's pulling from it. He mentions manifestos of previous attackers, and he is inspired by them. So in that sense, there was not the content wasn't new, but it was being put together. And I think what is really important, or something we should not underestimate, is how malignant the ideology is, and it is his ideological extremism.
How malignant is it? How widespread is it? You obviously have studied this. How powerful is it?
Well, we saw the attacks in New Zealand, right? But this is not the first, right? We also saw the attacks in Norway. But if you look at just in America, we saw the attack on the Pittsburgh synagogue, right? In Quebec, we saw an attack on a mosque where six people were killed. So this is nothing new. And we are seeing these attacks on houses of worship, which have been going on for a long time now. We saw Dylann Roof attack the church in South Carolina. So the thing is that this is another person, but it's the same. It's versions of the same ideology.
Which is white supremacy.
Yes, exactly. So it's the spectrum of right wing, and they don't hesitate to actually, again, so they are, when they mobilize, like every other terrorist groups, they are willing to kill.
Kathleen Belew, again, you've also spent time studying this. What should we be learning from this by now after all these incidents?
You know, this is a social movement. I think this is the most important thing to understand. This is an action carried out by the white power movement. It has decades of history in the United States and beyond. It is part of a social groundswell. Its members are deeply connected with one another, and they're ideologically driven, as my co-panelists have said. That means that we have to think about how to connect these disparate acts of violence together into one story so that we can start to think about formulating a response to this as a movement. These aren't lone wolf attacks. These aren't individual errant madmen. These are political actors who understand what they're doing to be motivated and purposeful. And the other thing about acts like this, I'm a historian. I study the period from the Vietnam War to the Oklahoma City bombing, which is the moment of sort of formation of this movement and its kind of first wave of intense radicalization and anti-state violence. When we think about acts like the New Zealand shooting, the Oklahoma City, the massacre in Charleston, the attack on the Tree of Life Synagogue, these actions are not meant to be the end in and of themselves. The violent action, the mass attack, that's not the end point of this ideology. These actors envision these acts as purposeful political statements meant to awaken a broader white public to the urgency of their ideology and to race war.
And race war, literally.
Yes. That's why I think it's important to call this what it is, which is the white power movement. I think when people say white nationalist or white supremacist, it serves to sort of soften the very radical and revolutionary nature of this activism. White nationalist makes people sort of think that the nation implied is going to be the nation of the United States or the nation of New Zealand, when in fact these activists think about a white nation that transcends national boundaries. They're pursuing an Aryan nation, and they're often doing this violently with the end goal of ethnic cleansing and race war.
So Matthew Knott, knowing that this is that serious, that what they really want is elimination of people who are not white, is that recognized in Australia?
I think it is going to be now. I think this is a big wake-up call for everyone in Australian politics and in Australian media that the rhetoric and our discourse matters, and you have to be careful about where it goes and what you tolerate. And the things that our security agents say again and again is that to work with Muslim communities, you need to not put them offside and to have the type of rhetoric we've had by mainstream politicians is not helpful in that. So this is already prompting a lot of soul-searching in Australia about what has become normalized in our discourse.
And Humaira Khan, what about the response here in the United States? President Trump was asked about this today. He said he does not think that white nationalism is a problem in this country. He says it's just a small group of people. What sort of response are you seeing today from our leaders to this?
There's an inadequate one, perhaps, is perhaps the best way of saying it. Like, we need to acknowledge that this was domestic terrorism, right? That this is terrorism and it has to be dealt with from that perspective. I know this is today the House Homeland Security Committee actually asked the FBI for information on domestic terrorism. So I think that's a start. But it can't end there, because what we've had is for years this issue has not been pursued enough, right? One question I keep asking is, where are the prevention programs? Right, where is actually the strategic plan, the leadership, and the funding, which is going to be needed to actually counter, not just counter, but also prevent this issue?
Do you see any movement in the part of the U.S. government to do that?
At this moment, no. Hopefully that will change. But I think there needs to be. But it's also not just the government. This is a place where, because as the professor described it, right, this is a movement. This is a social movement. It's not just up to the government or the government's responsibility to deal with it. Everyone has a responsibility, which means every sector of society. It means religious, the clergy, society itself, the education system. Everyone actually has to mobilize, recognize that this is an issue and deal with it.
Kathleen Ballou, back to you. I mean, how do you see whether it's the United States or Australia or other countries, but clearly, you know, we're a program in the United States. What can this country be doing about this now?
So when we think about this kind of a movement, it is a fringe movement. It is a comparatively small group of people. But the thing is that people in fringe movements have outsized capacity for violence and outsized capacity for spreading ideas into other circles. I think that this is a movement, and the history shows this, that has really done a lot of work to disguise itself and to appear as sort of scattered lone acts of violence. And we see over and over again the idea of the lone wolf attacker, the madman, a few bad apples, when in fact these are coherent and connected actions. So the work of contextualizing them, putting them in conversation with one another, and understanding these events as connected is absolutely crucial if we want to mount any kind of public response. This movement uses a strategy called leaderless resistance, which is effectively very much like cell-style terror. The idea is that a cell or one man can work to foment violence without direct communication with leadership. And this was implemented, of course, to stymie prosecution in court, and that's one level of response. The larger consequence of leaderless resistance has been that our society as a whole has not been able to understand this violence.
Well, it's clear. We have heard so much about Islamic terrorism. It is very clear now that we need to look at white supremacy as another form of terrorism. Kathleen Ballou, Matthew Knott, Humaira Khan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The attacks in Christchurch have had reverberations across the globe. Joining us to discuss the political reaction here, as well as other political news of the week, is senior Washington correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, good morning.
Good to be with you, Melissa.
Let's talk about the long, hate-filled document that the suspected shooter issued. In that document, he mentions President Trump. He also writes about the Second Amendment. He talks about stirring discord, instigating a potential civil war in the U.S. over gun control. What has President Trump said in response?
Leaders everywhere are condemning the attack as appalling, but President Trump said it was a horrible, horrible act. And if it casts a pall everywhere, there may be a special darkness to it here in the U.S. The alleged shooter, as you say, singled us out. Also in that screed, the alleged shooter asks himself if he's a Trump supporter, and he answers initially, as a symbol of renewed white identity and common purpose, sure. Now, then he adds, as a policymaker and leader, dear God, no. But he also uses this word invasion in reference to non-Europeans, the same word the president used and defended yesterday in a news conference about the U.S. southern border. At that time, the president was asked if he had any concerns about rising white nationalism, and he said this.
I don't really. I think it's a small group of people that have very, very serious problems. I guess if you look at what happened in New Zealand, perhaps that's a case. I don't know enough about it yet. They're just learning about the person and the people involved. But it's certainly a terrible thing.
Now, the White House says linking the president to the suspect in any way is outrageous. Still, it is a reminder that the political dialogue here reverberates beyond
our
own
shores. Constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, March 16, 2019, so I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have counter-racist suggestions, questions, views you would like to share pertaining to the clips that we just heard or anything that else that happened over the past week. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Few things to share before we get to the folks who dialed in. For one, we are listener-supported, counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. You can hit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. I got a new PayPal account at the beginning of last month, connected with the retreat. So if you had the old PayPal account and have just been using that, make sure that you have the updated new version. It is linked at the blog. You'll see the button in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, you can drop me an email and I can get you a physical mailing address. Tremendous gratitude to all of the listeners who have invested for a decade and kept the cows on the air. I hope the program has been, continues to be, worthy of your time and energy. You can also nab items from my Amazon wish list. It is linked under Gus T. Renegade. If you hit Amazon.com, my wish list is also linked directly at my blog. It's right beneath the PayPal button. Again, much obliged to all the listeners who have nabbed items over the last decade. I hope the cows has provided accurate, constructive information about what racism, white supremacy is, how it works, what it means to be classified as white, and what non-white people can do to solve this problem. All right, a list of things to share. First and foremost, the Cows Summer Yoga Retreat, July 3rd through July 7th, Lake Arrowhead, California. Think of all the so-called July 4th holidays you've had thus far. This one should be substantially different, better. We should have, I believe, a max of 13 spots total. We have beds. Super looking forward to comfortable resting. This time around, four bathrooms, private lake. We'll be doing yoga, morning and evening yoga, the same way we had yoga twice a day in Virginia. Plant-based meals. Chef Nadira Khalifa, she did all of the meals when we were in Virginia. I already spoke with her. She is down to fly cross-country to hang out with us for July 3rd through the 7th to prepare all plant-based meals for the entire time. We should be able to get, in addition to counter-racist workshops, we would also, well, I mean, it would just be one of the counter-racist workshops on preparation of vegan meals. That was something we did out in Virginia. I think it would be even better this time around. We can maybe even do two such workshops so that people could have questions and really come prepped if folks are serious about changing the way that they eat and thinking about self-care and what we put in our mouth, what we put on our plates as Black self-respect and counter-racism. Should be great, as well as exercise, doing yoga twice a day with all Black people. Super looking forward to it. The first $600 is due March 24, which I think is next Sunday. PayPal or check or money order. And then the final $350 is due June 7. Total $950 per person. July 3rd through the 7th. That's 5 days, 4 nights. All meals included, lodging included, morning, evening yoga, plant-based meals. I am looking forward to hanging out in California for the summertime. I have a blog post. In fact, if you go to the blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com, it has details, photographs, so you can see the tentative property. If you have questions, you can drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. Woof. I am hopeful we can do it up in California. No mud. And not in Virginia. Thank God. It was warm this week in Seattle. Wow. Now that the sun is coming back out, I am so thankful I am not in Virginia anymore. drop an email. Let me know if you have questions. Summer 2019, Cal's Yoga Retreat in California. Let's see if we can make it happen and make it constructive. Totally different way to do the so-called holiday. Next. Wow, so many yoga things to share this week, too. First up, the segment on Russell Westbrook. And I think this is important because they spent all that time before there was this the so-called college cheating scandal. That was the big thing this week, or at least what I saw. It seemed like a lot of attention was focused on that. And then the New Zealand shooting happened. With the New Zealand shooting, they talked about white supremacist rhetoric. They had several reports we just heard where they were talking about that. What becomes normalized to say? They even talked about that with Madison Grant, passing of the great race. We heard Cal's listeners should be very familiar with Madison Grant. We just talked about him on the program at the book club this past Thursday. Reading is more important than watching television. But what type of rhetoric, what type of speech is acceptable to say? Russell Westbrook, black male, NBA basketball player, Olympic gold medalist, NBA MVP. I mean, super credentialed. Russell Westbrook, and this could be workplace racism too. I could have played this on the Friday broadcast. I was really excited. I was looking forward to hearing Bill Roden. That was Mr. Bill Roden's podcast with Jamal Murphy. Black males who talk about racism, white supremacy on a regular basis. Mr. Roden, he authored $40 Million Slave, retired firefighter, was just talking about the book, I believe, this week. I was really looking forward, hoping that he was going to have a segment talking about Russell Westbrook. He did, and you heard it. And I was so disappointed, and that is rare. I think for people who listen to this program, it is rare for Gus T to say, oh, I was disappointed by something, because I really work aggressively to have expectations properly in line with the system of white supremacy so that I am not disappointed by things. Got me this time. I was so disappointed that BGQ. These are black people, victims of racism, discussing racism, white supremacy. They're qualified to take whatever position that they want to take. They said what they said. All of that. These are professional sports journalists. Like, that's what they do by profession. Mr. Roden has published books. He wrote a sports column for the New York Times for over two decades, about close to 30 years. And he continues to write for The Undefeated. Continues to write columns, the majority of which are focused on racism and athletics. Mr. Jamal Murphy co-hosts the program, also a black male sports journalist. He writes about athletics and racism regularly. They've been doing this program talking about this subject matter for years. So I'm expecting context. They said that putting these events into context. What happened with Russell Westbrook in Utah, where this white fan, white man and white woman were yelling at him, apparently yelled at him to get on your knees like you used to. That's what he's reported to have said to Russell Westbrook, this black male player. Now, I'm thinking that this is going to be put in context. What do I mean put in context? When I played that segment, what did I have at the beginning? I had the segment from Spike Lee's When the Levees Broke. Wonderful film, where he has a black mom, refugee. He has a black refugee from Katrina, and she's been dislocated to Utah. And you hear her saying, Utah? Now, if I really, had time to play around, I would have just continued over to the follow-up documentary, If God Is Willing and the Creek Don't Rise, where he goes back to talk to this refugee again. And she's no longer in Utah. And she says that she was the only black person there. And she didn't know that they didn't have any black people in Utah. And she started to get scared, thinking that the KKK was going to come and kill her. And she started having mental health problems. And she left. That's what I did to contextualize the segment on Russell Westbrook. If I really had time like I do now, hey, let me put my feet up and flex a little bit. And I didn't do any research on this. This is just, hey, how much has Gus T. read about Utah? So I would have said J.R. Smith NBA champion, teammate with LeBron James in Ohio. He did a GQ article, I believe, the same year they won the championship. I didn't research this just to make a point. In GQ magazine, where he was asked, you know, what's tough about the NBA? And he said, playing in Utah, where they call you nigger. I was waiting, thinking that they were going to say that. I was waiting, thinking that they were going to mention that feverish Dennis Rodman. You can insert the cowbell, Pam. That feverish Dennis Rodman. Infamous, won an NBA championship, two of them, Trump and the Utah Jazz. And him saying, man, you got these flipping Mormons out here. And oh my goodness, they went berserk on feverish Dennis Rodman. I think he got fined way more than $25,000, what Russell Westbrook got fined. But he got fined and oh my goodness, religious persecution and all of it against that feverish, no good Dennis Rodman. Bob Avakian, suspected racist, even looked at that incident with Dennis Rodman and said, man, if he had just said we got these racist Mormons out here in Utah who don't like black people, they have a whole history of excluding black people from their religious practice, the religion of white supremacy, then it would have just been, wow, that Dennis Rodman is feverish, but he is talking straight facts. That's what I was waiting to hear. When they went to Russell Westbrook in Utah and this white man saying, get on your knees, and you can add the delectable Negro human consumption and homoeroticism in U.S. slave culture. Top 10, Vincent Woodard. Top, how often do I have to mention the book? But I mean, it has a sexual connotation to it. Another, a man telling another male, get down on your knees. It has a sexual connotation to it, unless, you know, I'm just being berserk, which could be. But that's, you know, the type of thing that I was thinking we were going to hear. And that's not what I heard. I heard a lot of laughing and joking. And one thing I guess I hope we have stressed and demonstrated on this broadcast over a decade is be serious when it's time to be serious. When it's time to talk about white supremacy, racism, that is serious. And that's not saying that you can't smile. That's not saying that you can't laugh. But I mean, there was a lot of laughing and joking in a segment that I think should have been very serious. Russell Westbrook seemed serious. He was not laughing, talking about what was happening. He was the victim in the situation. And even just looking at the details of how the situation was reported in that segment, they said that they mentioned that Russell Westbrook doesn't think things out, that he gets upset. He yelled back when this white man reportedly said, get on your knees like you used to. He got upset and they didn't catch that on camera. But what, of course, they caught on camera was him telling this white man that I will F you up. I will F you and your wife up. Love Russell Westbrook. That is certainly not counter racism, but love Russell Westbrook not leaving out the race soldier white woman in the equation. That is not what I would advocate for workplace racism. I do not think that is the best way to handle if a white man or white woman calls you a nigger or says, get on your knees. I do not think cursing at them and being emotional is the best way to handle it. That might cause you some more problems. All of that said, in my view, number one, to say that Russell Westbrook doesn't think things out, that sounds very much like what I would expect a racist to say about black people, that we can't think, particularly black athletes, that they can't think, all of them. You know, they're just that brawn, muscle, you need a white man to coach him up. We showed you Sandra, the great Sandra Bullock. She showed you that in The Blind Side. You need a white man or sometimes even a white woman, brains, to come in and get that black brawn to do right. Go out there and get that championship. That's why you got to have a white coach. That's why we don't hire nigger coaches in the NFL, or don't hire too many of them in the NBA either. But this notion that that's why I said his credentials at the beginning, he has an Olympic gold medal and an NBA MVP. I don't think you can do all that and not think things out. And even his response, I'll even pause on his response in Utah, because racists are yelling at him all the time. They mentioned the incident with the white child. They, in my view, as journalists, did a terrible job reporting that incident. This was from just a few days ago. This wasn't ancient history.
this white child, I believe this was in Denver, because I actually saw this, not the game, I saw the replay. This white child, race soldier, what do you say, racist man, racist woman, racist child, this white child looks like he was probably about 12, shoves Russell Westbrook from behind. Russell Westbrook's back's to him. And this little urchin shoves him. Russell Westbrook didn't turn around not thinking and growl and bite his head off. I'm a savage, you know, feverish bee. He didn't do that. He turned around. He looked. He was upset. He turned around and looked. And then it was like he grasped that it was a child who did this. He didn't go off on the child's dad, whatever that means. That's what the verbiage that was used in the segment, go off. He didn't go off on this, in my view, racist child. He didn't go off on the race soldier parent. He leaned over calmly and said to the father, hey, you can't have your child just shoving people out in public. I mean, what? And I mean, really, if an adult had done this, they would have been ejected. You can't touch players. They would have been ejected immediately. And in my view, they should have been. They should have followed the exact same procedure with that little urchin. You know the rules. You're old enough to come sit courtside. You're old enough to follow the rules. You need to come and get aggressive and get violent with a nigger. Well, then we can show you the exit too. Good night, young fella. That's what should have happened. That's not what happened. Russell Westbrook was super classy, total gentleman. They commented on that and said that was great. They even talked to him after the game. And he said, I didn't even know who shoved me. If someone had just shoved you from behind, you don't know who it is. He could have turned around with an elbow, like, back up off me. What's going on here? He didn't do that. He turned around, assessed, and calmly used his words. That's what I was expecting from the report, and they didn't say that. It was presented like, again, Russell Westbrook is just some savage nigger from the ghettos of L.A., and, you know, that explains his behavior. You know, he's just one of these uncouth niggers like that Ron Artest fella. And that is not what I was expecting at all from the segment. And in fact, it didn't even sound like it was being presented as though the white people are most to blame for this. And in fact, this is a part of their whole history of black athletics with racists, whether it's Jackie Robinson, whether it's Serena Williams, Indian Wells, whoever it is, J.R. Smith, I just mentioned, whomever the individual happens to be, Muhammad Ali, Jack Johnson, pick your person, coming out to yell at the nigger. I don't care what they win. What did they say about Tiger Woods? I hope he doesn't serve us fried chicken. Wasn't that Fuzzy Zeller? I don't care what the nigger sport is. Let's come out and yell at the nigger. I don't care how many rings they have. I don't care how many trophies. Bill Russell, pick the sport, pick the era, pick the world. If the nigger's on the field, let's go out and yell at him. Let's go out and throw bananas at him. Let's go out and throw trash at him. I don't follow soccer, so I don't know all the players, but I know that's every day. They're throwing bananas and making monkey chants at the soccer players across the... That's the context that I wanted that presented in about just having another racist yell at Russell Westbrook and why this is normalized, accepted racist behavior and what should be done to solve this problem. Mr. Roden, Jamal Murphy, they still have VGQ. I am actually going to message Mr. Murphy. We have contact. I've messaged him repeatedly. We've conversed messaging online over the years. I might even message him about this because I was surprised. I was very surprised at the tone of the segment. But moving forward, there were other important things that happened this week. The segment on the cheating scandal. Words are so crucially important. I thought it was skillful white supremacy that when they began talking about the so-called cheating scandal, affirmative action got brought up. Don't know what that has to do with affirmative action. Whites cheating, violating admissions standards so that their offspring can get access to higher education. I have no idea how that is connected to. What do I say about metaphors? They will connect and make analogies between two things as though these are similar, and that's not the case at all. Affirmative action is tacky, poor compensation for white people practicing white supremacy racism against black people in academics. That's what affirmative action is. We've not allowed you niggers to go to school for decades, centuries, really. So now we will maybe let 5 or 12 of you get through. Maybe. We'll see. That's affirmative action. Depends on how we feel. That's not this cheating scandal. And it's a double whammy, really. I shouldn't say that, but it's multiple facets of white supremacy racism being practiced, because it's not just making this inaccurate comparison. It's also with the affirmative action piece of it. Every time that that is brought up and it's implied, suggested that black people are the beneficiaries of affirmative action, that is a deliberate act of racism. It should be, if we're going to bring up affirmative action, it is white women, white people in general, white women specifically, who are by far the folks who benefited most from what they call affirmative action. So if that's the case, that's the way it should be presented. How do white women feel about this? White women have been given all of these set-asides, as they call them, whatever that means. White women have been the ones, not black people, because that's not even accurate. Continuing, just with that segment, that was Brian Lehrer, New York WNYC Public Radio. They said that it was unfair. They talked about the comparison, which I did think was great. The comparison between black parents, even though they didn't state it explicitly, it was so much of that in that segment, not speaking directly to what this is. Black parents who put in a different address so that their child can maybe get access to a better school, better killing field, metaphor. Black parents are jailed for this. We've talked about some of the reports about this. Pam has written about some of the reports about this. These white parents cheat, violate, break all the rules. Nothing happens. They get to do this. This has probably been going on for years, and you know, more people involved and in more ways than we can even think and determine. And he says, yeah, when you have poor parents, he didn't even say black, when you have poor parents, other parents who do this so that their children can get access to better schools, it's unfair. That right there, again, regularly, Mr. Fuller, myself, others recommend not using the word fair. In my view, that is a deliberate act of racism, white supremacy. The white man not saying that this is racism, white supremacy, when we shackle and cage black parents who are trying to get their children into the best schools that they can, as opposed to, oh, it's unfair. It was so many things just within that segment about how it was presented, and just again not speaking accurately to racism, white supremacy. The shooting, if we have folks who have read the manifesto, that would be great to hear some of the details. I've not had an opportunity to read all of the report. Suspected race soldier Britton Tarrant, I think is how you say it. But if we have folks who've read the manifesto, if anything stands out, definitely share. I thought in the report when they said it was one of New Zealand's darkest days, I know that is in the word guide from Mr. Fuller. Again, that's why I talk about these metaphors of not, or just being mindful about metaphors, because a lot of times they reinforce the system of racism, white supremacy, regularly associating black darkness with something vile, evil. It's the darkest day, even though it was a white man who carried out this terrorist attack. And they said that several times, one of the darkest chapters in American history, when they were talking about Madison Grant and the passing of the great race. I have no idea what that is. Darkest chapters of American history, particularly as it relates to white supremacy, racism. And again, it's darkest chapters when we're talking about the misdeeds of individuals classified as white. I thought it was significant the folks that were referenced in the by the New Zealand perpetrator, even though they say he was born in Australia or a citizen of Australia. System is global. You have a white man who is not thinking in terms of racism, white supremacy, just in the location Australia or just in the location New Zealand. He is thinking about racism, white supremacy in global terms. And that's the way that we need to think in order to solve this problem as victims. But I thought that was super significant why we should be paying attention to events like that, for this to happen on the other side of the world. And he's talking about Dylann Roof and saying, oh yeah, he had it right. The one who went in there and killed those niggers in the church. Wow. We should be paying attention. I think that speaks speaks, I think, significantly to what Dr. Frances Cress Welsing talked about in terms of what it means to be white, white genetic annihilation, and even bring back the man. Now, Dylan Roof was talking a lot about the threat of black males. If folks have info to report, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. This is the compensatory call-in. If we could not use metaphors, as stated, one of the primary methods that whites practice racism, words, deception, they will consistently use metaphors, analogies, similes, comparisons, and insist that these two entities are identical. Frequently, that is not the case at all. The college admissions scandal, affirmative action. They do that sort of thing on a constant basis. These are acts of racism. That is master deceiver. Victims of racism, including Gus, we've been exposed to this conduct for centuries. It has had an impact, and many of us, we are still learning. As such, there are times when we don't have logic to articulate our thoughts, and such, as such, we will insert a metaphor to try to best convey our thoughts, and frequently that just adds to the confusion. If we could make an effort to be as explicit, direct about what it is we want to say, that would be grand. I will prompt about that. Much obliged. I had, yoga story. I have to give the yoga stories as we go. And I think there was one other bit of info. Oh, yes. I have three more things to share. I'll give yoga reports and other info as we proceed. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. First few folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Good evening, Gus.
Greetings, Thomas in New York.
Greetings, sir. Russell Westbrook, just last week, I mentioned that he was struck by the young fan. And so I see a pattern. So when I saw this incident happen, I already had in mind of what happened to him the week before. You talking brutal on black athletes, even their collegiate sports, BYU, very brutal on black athletes as well. I remember even the great Michael Jordan being mistreated in Utah. Utah also being that it doesn't have a lot of professional sports, gas tickets are hard to get and they're not cheap. So the fans pay a lot of money to get very close to the fans so they could degrade them during the game. So even a lot of the former players who are now commentators on the various NBA networks spoke about their experience playing in Utah and other stadiums where they were, you know, degraded by white fans. I think here at the Cal, instantly drew the connection between Dylan Roof and Anders Breivik because of their talent manifestos, as well as Elliot Rodgers. So I'm going to read that manifesto. About this college cheating scandal, I had quite a few points, so I'm going to go through them as fast as possible here. And the talk about white entitlement and white privilege, this white power. I remember reading that the former Attorney General in California, Kamala Harris, had locked up working homeless black women, one working homeless black woman, with four or five young children because her oldest child was skipping school, and she put a truancy law in. So keep that in mind. Also, to position that scandal as far as the FBI investigation, if you put it into the context of white supremacy, and mildly compare it to how the FBI investigates poor black people, it was done very differently. When the FBI go after and arrest small-time local drug dealers, they're much more thorough, in my opinion. We had a big arrest here in New York, in Queens, in the Queensbridge Housing Project, and the FBI and local police termed the operation The Bridge Is Over, a very popular song by rappers from that area. Here in Harlem, one time we had around the corner from you, they charged 61 people with drug conspiracy violations and things. They arrested children. We saw people out there with their wheelchairs, people on breathing machines. When I read up on the case, they had one apartment where one person was being arrested. It was 3 years ago. They let the person stash some drugs in their apartment, so they're caught up in the conspiracy. One person let someone use their phone a few months ago. They're caught up in the conspiracy. So now let's go back to these children, these college cheaters. They arrest dozens of rich white cheating children to get white people for cheating to get their children in these prestigious colleges. Happening both on the East and West Coast, colleges from Boston to North Carolina, all parts of California. So this, I think it's safe to say that happens everywhere in between. They Photoshop crop cut tapes, high school athletic careers, putting a face on a child who was hopping a pole vault as he was going over the pole, putting their kid's face there so they could say he was some type of good athlete. They lied about their acceptance into Scholastic Club, extracurricular organizations, their participation in volunteer work. They lied about interning. They lied about doing free tutoring and mentoring other younger kids that were less privileged. They lied about everything to create a complete profile on their child, sort of like you make your profile on Facebook or something. You can put whatever you want there. Now, some of these children, as rich as they are, couldn't, with all the good schools they go to, couldn't get good standardized scores and testing. So their parents cheat for that. They took some of them took college scholastic scholarships away from athletes who probably couldn't afford the college. One paid to get the SAT exam, where she had one single administrator who was her friend helping her child one-on-one. To me, all of those in college sites should be being investigated by the FBI. How are you doing these SAT sites and you don't have that being investigated? Doctors prescribe fake diagnosis to kids but they say they have mental disorders and physical disabilities to postpone the exams or get extra a couple of hours on the exam. To me, all of those doctors should be up before. All of those doctors should be looked into. The administration departments that all these schools mentioned should be looked into. The athletic department should be looked into. How do you have someone go from not playing high school sports into Division I college sports at NCAA level, which is the closest thing to professional and Olympic sport level, and you can't even play the sport? It was stand out. Someone had to know. The coaches, the trainers, someone had to know. The director of the athletic program, also, the children should be arrested. They had to know what their parents was doing. If they were younger, they should be charged as juveniles. If they're 18, they should be charged as adults. They should be publicly identified. Okay? We still haven't seen a mugshot from none of these other white people other than the two actors. All the grades they got, all their test scores should be marked to zero. Their test SAT scores should be voided. They should be starting from zero. All of these people, like I said, no mugshots. When do you see any time black people get arrested? They don't put the mugshots there. what we see is the two actresses, and they smiling in their face. Last couple things. This is the last part, Gus. And I'm sorry I took long on this. One of the actresses from, I think it was Full House, but the scandal was went through a nonprofit organization or some type of foundation. So she paid $500,000 to her two daughters in UCLA on athletic scholarships with made-up credentials, state test scores, countless videos of her daughter saying they didn't want to go to school. And her daughter was also a celebrity for vlogging about her makeup and stuff and designer clothes, got a deal with Sephora for six figures, so she didn't even need to go to school. The actress and her husband filed the taxes saying that the $500,000 went to a foundation. They got $400,000 back from the or in tax deduction from the IRS for donating the $500,000. So that if they were all doing this, this is huge tax fraud. All these people should lose their jobs instantly because look at the positions that they hold. But we don't see none of that happen. So I just think that's very interesting that here you go spending $500,000 to get your kids into a school illegally, and you get $400,000 of it back, plus you get your kid on a scholarship. I mute my line.
Thomas in New York, no mercy, saying they should have the SAT scores voided. My goodness. Woof. Punitive actions from Thomas in New York. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, if we've not heard from you at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter in Florida. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everyone. I'll start off with the first report. As probably everybody knows, Miami Beach, the city of Miami Beach, has spring break. Normally during this time where collegiate students and others of all different ages go to that area for spring break. You know, listen to music, romp up and down the street, and just use your imagination, and it's done in Miami Beach. In turn, the police chief of Miami Beach thought of a idea of informing colleges and universities in this part of the world about the schools to warn students about misbehaving in Miami Beach. And in turn, he got a very negative reaction, I would guess by powerful white people. Because this is something that may harm white young people as far as ruining their future with this type of situation in their record, because they do arrest a lot of people. And in turn, he already had sent some letters off for students who had been arrested. The one that was reported on the news was not even a guessing game, a historical black college out of all of the places that one of the letters was sent, and it was to Norfolk State University before the powerful white people went about the means of rejecting him to be able to do that. Moving on, down here in South Florida, there were several incidents involving law enforcement with non-white black people. The one with the case where the it was actually in court, the enforcement official who shot a black male who was an assistant Actually, he was on, he was at work at a mental hospital where he treats patients at a hospital and had his hands up laying on his back. He was actually shot. That enforcement official was acquitted on at least one charge, and other charges it resulted into a quote-unquote hung jury. They're thinking about retrying him again. This is the second one that I mentioned, I think last week, that appears to be a non-white person. I would suspect the reasoning on why that is very hard, even to prosecute a non-white person, is because that particular job has to, I guess strategy-wise, the white supremacists will have to have the these aggressive race soldiers to remain to be aggressive, and anything other than that, they basically would have problems with their race soldiers if they're not aggressive. But anyway, moving on, the other two incidents involved black females. Unfortunately, one was shot to death down here, not too far from where I stay at. Driving, the police, for some reason, was out with their weapons drawn. And the reason why I'm describing it, because it actually was on the news itself. Someone had their phone out at the time when all this was going on, including the shooting itself, where she the vehicle proceeded with the officer already had his gun drawn, and he started shooting. There were other occupants in the car, and in turn, she was shot to death. The other incident was involving two black females who had a gun drawn on them by what appeared to be a white male in his residence. She called, the black female actually called the police, and in turn, the police basically, one of the officers who actually was a person who trained enforcement officials on how to behave on calls of this nature, actually wrestled her to the ground, whereas the director of Dade County Police Department basically suspended him from duty, which is, you know, you really have to pay attention to the language in the story, because he didn't say anything that could be considered to be any type of accusing of anything of the officer itself. Basically, he just told him to stay home for a little while. That doesn't mean that he's going to have any trouble later on. Fortunately, it doesn't appear to be any physical harm to the lady, but nevertheless, she was wrestled to the ground, and she was the person who actually called the police. The story went viral, so all of these different stories you can get yourself from the news, and those are my reports. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Wow, not surprised. I feel like I've heard that sort of thing happen before about parties happening down in the Florida area and different acts of racism, especially when it's black people, black college students come into the Florida area to do any sort of partying, spring break, or any other celebrations. Lots of acts of racism being used to harm, mistreat, or even keep those black people from coming to the area. Other folks,
they even started price gouging in one case. It was one year where they was gouging prices, jacking prices up higher. Because they didn't want black people to be over there. Yeah.
By any means.
Another form of sundown town. Another form of sundown town, Miami Beach, Florida. where you actually used to have to have a passport. A black person had to have a passport. My aunt, who is deceased now, kept hers, and I actually saw it, a passport that you had to have, and you had to be out of there when the sun went down, after you did your cleaning. That's it.
Context of white supremacy. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you have commentary. I am reminded a caller in the Connecticut area who had discussed having difficulties with the exam. That's, I'm contrasting your white peers who mysteriously do not have these types of difficulties with the exam. They probably have the same type of scheme worked out so that they, you know, hey, passed. What do they say? What's the metaphor? With flying colors. I don't know if that's in the word guide or not, flying colors, but yeah, passed. Doing great. Moving on. Woo! That, when I say widespread, I remember this was discussed when I was in undergrad. I remember this being discussed. White fraternities, sororities having stockpiles of exams, which was not supposed to happen at the University of Virginia. They're all about the so-called honor code and all of that. You're supposed to turn in the exam, but white fraternities, sororities having, just a bank of exams so that you have the exact material to study for it. I mean, you have a perfect study guide at minimum, if not the outright test, so you already know what's going to be on the exam. And then, as I began to discuss racism, white supremacy, there was an exchange I had at the University of Washington. This was a white female student, suspected racist. She was really good friends with a non-white female who used to call into the cows regularly. She is practicing racism, trying to give an example of this non-white female who, I guess, got like a low grade on a test before she was about to matriculate to college. And the white professor or white teacher, high school teacher who gave her this low grade, this was jeopardizing whether or not she was going to go to college. And so he didn't want to give her a higher score. Like, this could have been rectified. I think the principal or someone may have just requested, like, hey, can you just, you know, bump her up to a D+, and, you know, everything will be solved. She can go off to college and we'll move on. And he was like, oh no, meritocracy. Isn't that what they say? She earned, let's say she got an F. She earned an F. And, you know, that's what she got. You know, that's what I'm giving her. You know, if she had earned a D, I would have given her a D. But, you know, meritocracy. And so she said, you know, hey, this is the story that this white woman is using, right, to discourage conversation on racism. Somehow she continues to talk within this and says, my high school principal volunteered to fill out my college exam. And I pause. Wait a minute. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Because she insists that she didn't take her up on this offer. I said, but wait a minute. You started this off trying to convince her, because I think she was the only white person present. That's why I said, in my mind, no doubt, act of white supremacy. You started this off to discourage, distract, really, our conversation of white supremacy. We had all non-white people, and I think I was the only person classified as black. But all non-white people courteously discussing white supremacy, problems they've had with it in their different geographic locations. And this race soldier brings up this story about an alleged black female who failed a class and wanted a free passing grade so that she could go to school. And it was you playing the race card, like, I'm a poor, deserving Negro. You need to help me out. And within that, she can't even contain her own white power by, oh yeah, my principal volunteered to fill out my college entrance exam. I said, you share that in the midst of trying to discourage, like, it. Anyway, she promptly hushed after things were pointed out correctly. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello.
Go ahead.
You can go. I'm fine. Go ahead, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you. Greetings, Gus, and greetings for all the callers on the line. Because I missed the book club, I actually wanted to... Am I echoing?
No, ma'am.
Okay. I wanted to speak about Dr. Curry's book. I'm very grateful for his book, and I'm grateful for him. I'm grateful for the tremendous work that he did, especially given how white people have done so much and continue to do so much to conceal the wonderful information that he shared. That said, I want to speak on some things that I think are inaccurate in the book. He made a statement that he said that the livelihood of black people in academia, that it depends on them treating us worse than our historical counterparts, so then treating us worse than anybody in history. Well, the thing is, he didn't have any examples of that. He didn't have any proof. He didn't have anything. It was something that he just said. And to me, that was something that was just stuck in there that he had to say in order to have the book published. Because as you pointed out, you know, there was a lot of criticizing of black people. And allegedly, white people forced us in history when we were supposedly in the 1800s, what's known as slavery, forced our men to rape our women, allegedly, which I'm starting to doubt that now, but supposedly that happened. Okay, well, if that's true, where is the proof that anybody in academia is doing any worse than that, that they are just raping us on a regular basis or doing something worse than that on a regular basis? And also, I wonder if that's supposed to be true, that they forced our men to rape our women. Did they force our women to rape our men? Because there's always this narrative of black men raping women. He also had false higher rates of domestic violence, saying that black people have higher rates of domestic violence than whites. I had this conversation with him online, and he conceded that the totals completely contradict that. That the totals show far higher rates of domestic violence between white people than between black people. And he insisted on ultimately white people's manipulation of statistics and trying to compare totals against population amounts and things of that nature, which most people are not having domestic violence between each other. So population amounts don't mean anything to the people actually suffering domestic violence. So, you know, per 100,000 population, that's just irrelevant. And white people know that, and they use that with discretion. So sometimes they use totals, and sometimes they use per population, whenever it suits them. Also, he used the term negrophobia, which is a white term that suggests that that white people are afraid of black people. They're not. They wouldn't abuse us if they were. We don't abuse them because we're afraid of them. I'm going to keep saying that every time this notion of white people being scared of black people comes up. He stated that because of an Ebony magazine article, some white men were saying that the suicide rate between black people was higher than white people. That's a lie as well. The leading cause of death in that age group, I think it was 15 to 19 or something like that, whatever age group he mentioned. It was, I think, the second leading cause of death for white people and the third for us. So, no, the statistics don't bear that out, and they never have. There was this emphasis on black people spanking our children, corporal punishment, they call it. White people do that more than anyone. Most preachers are white, and preachers believe in this, I guess, verse in the Bible that says, if you spare the rod, you spoil the child. And so they believe in that. And again, most preachers are white, and they talk about that a lot. And white people, they follow that a lot. I also thought the book was very repetitious. Like, he kept saying the same thing over and over and over and over again. Last couple of things I'll say is that his language also was very white, where he used words like white supremacism and things like that. He could have just said, you know, white supremacy. But white people, they have these crazy words just so that they can, like, act like they're smart. Not to say that they aren't, but I'm saying that they just say words that to just try to be really confusing. And you asked a question in that. You asked if black people have a problem associating homosexuality with child rape. No, they do not. In my experience, most of the time when homosexuality between black people come up, it is associated with homosexuality. I had other things, but I'm out of time, so I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus, and thanks to the woman who let me go in front of her. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Ivy. Impromptu book club. Reading is more important than watching television. Glad we had several folks who took advantage to ask Dr. Curry questions. Things didn't make sense, or if they thought something was incorrect, to question or ask him about that directly. And I've heard from several folks that he responded when they reached out with questions or comments about the text. So take advantage. Book Club, Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We're now doing James Loewen, Sundown Towns. James Loewen, race soldier. The female caller who yielded, much obliged, ma'am.
Hello. Sorry, hello. Good evening. Thank you for taking my call. I hope everyone's having the best evening they can have. I talked about a couple of things. The manifesto, I haven't seen it, but I guess it's been reported that he quoted the black conservative known as Candace Owens, how she supposedly influenced him. I believe he wrote something, and yes, he may put his name in it, but sometimes I think white people, well, not sometimes, but white people do things to throw us off, throw other people off, because I guess the manifesto, I haven't found it. I guess they tried to take it down, but someone, it also said that he said China was great. So he's supposed to be a white supremacist, but he's following China and a black person. So I don't understand that. I guess I would have to read the manifesto for myself to get a better understanding. In terms of the college information, that is, I guess, I believe it because I went to, I live in Georgia, but I'm from New York, and I went to, I had to test into a high school, which that was an experience. And my father, he lied, ooh, and said he was a guidance counselor so I could take the test, ooh. But I didn't get any study hints. I didn't know what the test would look like. I thought it would look like a regular New York City test, but it wasn't. But I don't know. I got in. He didn't help. They didn't help with that because they didn't know. But when I was at school, it lasted for a while. And when I was a junior, I remember they had a seminar. And usually I wouldn't care if my parents went to stuff like that. They went. They would go to school. They were attentive. But there was this particular seminar about the financial aid. So I was like, you have to come. I don't know what they're going to say, but you have to come. And so we all went, I think. Well, I know me and my father went. He had more money. My parents were divorced. Yeah, we all went. And they were talking about how to move the money around and all these things to make sure, you know, you look as poor as possible. Now, my school was 60% white, about 30% Asian, I guess 10% Hispanic and black together. And it was a public high school. It didn't cost anything, but a lot of people from the school went on to Harvard and Yale. There's one on the Supreme Court. One wrote a play you may have heard of called Hamilton. So these are the people, you know, this is the high school I went to. I haven't done what they've done, but, you know, this is the high school that I went to, and that is true. You know, I can believe everything that went on. I'm not saying I went to school with stupid people. They seem to do well. I don't really ask people what their grades were on papers and stuff. I just did the best I could do. I know one time we were in class, I got a good grade, and other students didn't. And this white girl, she called me a B, and I was like, okay, whatever. And I just kept it moving. Proceeded with the rest of my day because there's just some things I don't have time for. But yes, I can totally believe this happened. They talk about these things all the time and what they do. It happens all the time. And I was in the seminar. They invited a man to talk about financial aid and how they have people help you work not only do tax returns, but specialize in that financial aid preparation. You know, it's easy when you don't have any money for 000. But if you do, because they ask you about IRAs, stocks, mutual funds, they ask you everything. So, yes, I believe that definitely what happens has happened. And they are working. I'm sure they still have their seminar. Now I've been out of school. I guess it'll be almost 20 years next year. I guess it's not how old I am. But that's what they do.
Context.
I'm sorry, more than 20 years. I'm older than that. I've been out of high school more than 20 years. Oops. Guess when you get old, your mind goes. But, yes.
That's what they say. That's what they say. Victims of white supremacy. And you have not done what your classmates have done. You are on a totally different assignment. Hopefully, helping to replace white supremacy with justice. I think that is much more important than Hamilton or whatever else your schoolmates have done. Other folks who have dialed in, if you have commentary to share, line should be. It does seem that whites are working to not like publicize. Like I remember Elliot Rodger, I think is his name. His so-called manifesto or the manifesto attributed to him, I think it was widely available. I think like mainstream news outlets like the New York Times and such, I think had links to his manifesto and Dylann Roof. I think it was pretty widely available. This one, I've seen reports where they have been taking it down. So it might not be as easy to locate. Others who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. This is Victim in Austin calling. I wasn't able to hear any of the news stories, unfortunately, because I'm on the plantation. So I'll just try to make this quick. This is regarding the terrorist attack that happened in New Zealand. I was reading an article on the New Republic, and I think that it helps validate Dr. Kress's theory of white genetic annihilation. So I'm just going to read it quickly, or part of the article anyway, quickly, that I think is relative to this issue. But it says here, and I think the article was titled The Longer History of Christchurch Attacks. But it says the first victims of white supremacy in New Zealand and Australia where the latest killer was born were indigenous inhabitants. But by the late 19th century, white colonists had also turned that sentiment against the imagined influx of undesirable immigrants from Asia. The gold rushes of the 1850s brought the first Chinese immigrants to both Australia and New Zealand. Curiosity turned to hostility as the mines were exhausted, and Chinese miners moved off in search of other opportunities. By the 1880s, both New Zealand and Australia, Australian self-governing colonies, had enacted immigration regulations that made Chinese immigration prohibitively expensive and therefore nearly impossible. Remoteness from Britain and proximity to Asia, white New Zealanders and Australians proclaimed toward the end of the 19th century would bring racial degeneration and ruinous economic competition unless they maintained a total commitment to white territorial, political, and economic control. As one representative explained to the Victorian Parliament in 1899, we have a territory with a suitable climate, with a sparse population, while on the other hand, we have quite adjacent to our shores hundreds of millions of a very undesirable class of people. The same sentiments were echoed in legislative bodies, newspapers, and trade union halls all over Australia and New Zealand, and the same solution was repeatedly volunteered. In the words of that same Victorian legislator, it should be one of our ideals to maintain, if possible, a pure Australian blood or a pure British blood or a pure British and European blood within the shores of Australia. Now, what followed was the White Australia policy and its lesser-known analog, the White New Zealand policy. The former was enacted almost immediately upon the Federation of the Australian Commonwealth in 1901. In the words of Australia's first Attorney General and future Prime Minister, Alfred Deakin, the new Immigration Restriction Act demonstrated that at the very instant of our national career, we are as one for a white Australia. The new law empowered immigration officers to exclude non-white immigrants on the grounds of literacy rather than color. New Zealand had instituted a similar policy in 1899. These laws, encouraged by the British government, which opposed explicit racial exclusion for diplomatic reasons, derived from a similar policy adopted by the British colony of Natal, which in turn took its cue from so-called educational tests designed to prohibit African Americans voting in the American South. Now, in 1908, some white New Zealanders and Australians sensed an opportunity to connect with white supremacist allies in the United States. President Theodore Roosevelt had recently dispatched a newly constructed American battle fleet on the circumnavigation of the globe, and from August to September of 1908, that so-called Great White Fleet visited Auckland in New Zealand and Sydney, Melbourne and Albany in Australia. Some legislators embraced the racial implications of the American visit, especially in the context of deteriorating U.S. relations with Japan over the issue of immigration restrictions. Liberal MP William Stewart spoke for many when he declared, and this is the part that I believe is very relevant, when he declared that the brown and yellow races will challenge the white race for the possession and occupancy of the earth unless white colonists rallied around American naval strength in the Pacific. The New Zealand Times agreed, pronouncing that the fleet's visit a bold, emphatic assertion of the dominance of the white race. Some white Australians expressed similar hopes, with the Prime Minister Andrew Fisher later enunciating a plan to join with the Americans as far as we may in keeping the Pacific for the Anglo-Saxons. While the initiatives came to naught, their intention was unmistakable. That's all that I have from the article. Thank you.
Much obliged. Reading is more important than watching television. The whites-only policy in Australia is pretty publicized. I think that is the first time that I've heard about New Zealand's whites-only policy. Not that I, you know, was ignorant about white supremacy racism being practiced in New Zealand, but absolutely put that in context. Other folks who dialed in, if we have missed you totally, we have basically 40 minutes left. Oh, yikes.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
How's it going, everyone? This is Black Male Engineer. Just want to say Dr. Frances Cress Welsing was a genius. Her theories are being tested and proven true weekly, monthly, daily. The New Zealand shooter, I read his manifesto. It just proved everything she talked about. White people are afraid of being wiped out genetically from this planet. And in acting out that fear, this is more in line with Dr. Amos Wilson. There will be a lot of violence. I remember he was saying that about 2019, 2020 is when you'll start to see the Chinese really make their presence known on the world stage in terms of trying to kick America out. And we're seeing that with the situation with Huawei and how America, like the whites, were able to get Canadian whites to arrest a non-white female in a foreign country that America has no jurisdiction over. I just thought that situation was crazy. And this goes into the situation with the New Zealand shooter because no matter what non-white people can think, white people feel a sort of kinship amongst each other. So in these situations, that's why they're rallying around America. That's why they're saying we need to help make sure that America breaks up into ethno states, and it's just all very interesting that everything that's been written from the grandcestors is coming to pass. So I would say that Black people in America, Europe, if you're around a lot of whites, I would definitely purchase firearms, because with the coming recession, it's going to get worse in terms of violence. And, you know, that's just kind of that. I had a workplace racism incident. I'm at this agency where we're selling, like, insurance, life insurance and everything. And there's this white man there today. And while he's talking to us about trying to, you know, get everyone in shape, get everyone pepped up and happy, he says, "I'm going to whip y'all into shape." But the way he said it like, "I'm going to whip y'all into shape." And, you know, this is like white man, you know, and I'm just looking like, "I'm going to be the," and he, you know, after he said that, he was like, "I'm going to be the slave driver and I'm going to whip y'all into shape." And I'm sitting here in a room full of black people and I'm wondering, like, did this white man just say this? And then there was another non-white black person there, male, who, instead of condemning what he said, proceeded to join in on them and make the same kind of, I guess, I don't know what to call it, like slave accent, you know? And I don't know, that was just weird. So I think there's a lot of racism going on where non-white people feel like repressed and they're just acting out and just going along with what the whites say. I think that's very dangerous in a lot of these job situations, and that's pretty much it.
Much obliged. Workplace racism. Workplace racism. Neutralizing workplace racism is Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Talk about those metaphors. Whipping y'all into shape. I think that might be one. Put that in the journal. That might be one for a question. Might be one not to say anything. Just write that down. Whipping us into shape. Is that it, sir? Question.
Yeah.
And then you can write it down. Oh, I thought someone's going to say. But yeah, it's a lot of different ways you could go with that one. Not surprised. I think there have been a number of different incidents. I think someone even before mentioned an incident in the job where some white person posted some sort of image of a person being lashed. And it was like a threat, like, if this is what will happen if you don't fill out your time card or something of that nature. So I think whites are not ignorant about racism, white supremacy, regardless of whether or not they know who Madison Grant is. They know what a nigger is and they know white supremacy. And I think they many individuals classified as white have an affinity for that sort of language and wishing they could make America great again, get that whip in their hand and lash a darky once or twice. They know what they're doing and saying. Others who dialed in, if we missed you totally, you should speak up.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Call in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to guests, the hosts, the listeners, and callers. I agree with the portion where they went to talk about affirmative action and bringing in non-white people classified as Asian. And I think they are definitely practicing racist exploitation toward that sector of non-whites, because I've heard Richard Spencer and people like that going to talking about the IQ of people classified as Asian and juxtaposing it with their own supposed IQ. So, and another story where they had a non-white Asian male in a California high school. I think this was like last year, to put together some kind of a IQ intelligence graph or something, like a science project, and it caused a lot of controversy over in that area. So I think the white supremacists are trying to definitely, I'm going to use exploit that group for their own benefit, because, like as you said, they are the primary beneficiaries of the affirmative action dynamic. And then to put emphasis on it, two white women that were presented in the media for, mainly for engaging in doing something illegal, with putting their two their children, trying to get them into these elite institutions, educational institutions, and they're saying like, hey, the young white girl is saying, you know, I don't even want to go to school. I just want to party and go to some kind of frat party or something like that. I just want to drink and do this. I don't even want to go to school. And then you align that with these reports and saying that she was on a yacht somewhere, and then she had to just leave from there and come back. And it shows that it reminded me of a question Mr. Fuller got from a victim saying about, I guess when he made the comment about how white people are smart, and I think he answered it when it meant that they are collectively smart, because individually, like this situation, you know, they don't have to show intelligence in that sense of being in school, but they know that they're white. That's the primary thing. Like, I can get D's or F's or C's. I got people that'll work for me. I got people that'll deceive other people extremely and digitally alter photos, make them think that it's me, and appeal to some kind of policy for an athlete, I guess, standard from what they were saying, that how they can get into school. And they can just go and party and be on yachts and stuff. So that's still like racism, white supremacy. And they were saying, well, you know, it's the privileged wealthy. No, it's white right. power. That's what right. it is right there. That's and right. they're not the using direct that's language.
Right.
And my last one is there was a report I saw here locally where, unfortunately, another victim was killed in one of the residential areas on the other side of town. And there was a comment a black female made where they were saying that no one wants to listen to us. And she used the word community. And she said the only way that they feel like they have power is when they have a gun. So that was interesting. They read that. They played that news report locally. And that's all I have for now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. I think that is a great point about white power and correct terms not being used. I thought that was especially the case in the report on the so-called cheating scandal. That's where white power should have been invoked. That is a tremendous illustration of white power that we don't have to try, exactly as you stated. Like, we got a network of folks who will, you know, do all of this and hook us up with, you know, the best counterfeit high school credentials you can buy. And yeah, we're all good. Like, I don't have to study. I don't have to do volunteer work. I don't have to go and, you know, join the honors club. You know, I don't have to join any of these clubs or anything. Do good academic work. I'm white. That's going to take care a lot. And I'm not ignorant about white supremacy racism. I'm brilliant at that. And I know that's going to take a lot of take care of a lot of problems in and of itself. But that's where white power should have been invoked in that report. Speaking of Dr. Welsing, her birthday would be coming up. Sabrina Johnson, she's been a guest on this broadcast multiple times. She and others are coordinating a memorial to in honor of Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. For those in the D.C. area, It is tomorrow afternoon at 4 p.m. Eastern at the Thurgood Marshall Center. The address is 1816 12th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C. It's tomorrow afternoon, 4 p.m., Washington, D.C., at the Thurgood Marshall Center. I have her, Sabrina Johnson's email address. I can post the flyer if folks would like to share. If you're in the D.C. area, might be worth the time to stop in and share your appreciation and how you are demonstrating your appreciation for Dr. Welsing's work with Sabrina Johnson and others who probably spent a good bit of time and energy at the Welsing Institute and might have some constructive views to share, remembrances in honor of Dr. Welsing. But that's tomorrow afternoon, 4 p.m. Eastern in Washington, D.C. If we missed anyone, you should definitely speak up now. There are folks, if you had additional comments that you wanted to make sure you share, we have a little less than 30 minutes. The number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Caller at 6260, did you have commentary?
Yes, real quick, guest. I'd like to say hi to you and your guests. I hope everyone is well tonight. And I didn't really have time to really pay in-depth attention to the segments that you were playing earlier because I was at work and I just got off. But I have written down some notes about a couple of documentaries that I watched. Not sure if you've heard of this, but this was during the time of Hurricane Katrina. And you mentioned, Hurricane Katrina and what happened to the victims during that time often. But there's a documentary called Bayou Blue. It's about a rapist. He's a white male. He was a rapist and he was gay. He was a serial killer. What he was doing, he killed at least 23 men, and the majority of the men were black males. He did this for over a 10-year stand, and his name is Ronald Joseph Dominique. Not sure if you knew about that. I don't think he got any type of national attention. He didn't do the Jeffrey Dahmer thing, but that's a pretty significant amount of black males that were murdered. He would tie them up, offer them some type of sex with a woman, and he would tie them up, and then he would rape them, and then he would murder them, and then drop their bodies off in different remote areas all throughout. Where was Katrina? Was that in Louisiana?
Yes, ma'am.
Is that where the bayou is? Yes, okay, so that's where he was dumping the bodies at. And they ended up catching this guy. He's supposed to, I forget how many life sentences. And then the other thing I wanted to mention, there was another documentary that I watched. I was talking about the Flint water crisis, I think it was last week. So I was watching this documentary, and they mentioned that right after the documentary was about the Flint water crisis, and right after, I'm not sure if you know that right after the crisis, they have an area over in Flint, Michigan, where there's a lot of abandoned buildings and houses and things like that. I guess you would say, some would say it like reminds you of like projects. Well, what happened was the military, they had the military come into their area of Flint, Michigan, and this is still during the time of the water crisis. And they were actually doing testing, actually doing live fire practice on those buildings and in that area and did not mention anything to the residents in that area. They were showing how the military was like blowing holes through the walls of the buildings, and it was just like it was just basically terrifying. Like you could hear the live ammunition and shots being fired, and they did not let anybody know. So it kind of makes me think, like, you know, all of this, you know, how they tested it and how they basically allowed this to happen with the water crisis. And then right after that, the military came in and was doing practicing testing, just like kind of reminds you of Puerto Rico, how they do the bomb testing and things like that over there, how they was doing it over there. That's basically what they did over in Flint, Michigan. Wasn't sure if you had heard about any of those incidents, but I just wanted to relay that information out to you and the guests. And that's all I had.
Much obliged, Draptomania. Had not seen those films or heard of those reports. That is, you know, standard operations in the system of white supremacy, especially for a white terrorist to go out, another white identity extremist to go out if he was targeting a suspiciously high number of black males. And for that to not get any sort of attention, people are not talking about it. It's, you know, killing black people, killing black males, you know, who cares? We got other things to, what is that no good Colin Kaepernick up to, you know? but I had not heard of either of those events. I will definitely do some investigating. Other folks who dialed in, if they have commentary they would like to share, *61 if you have a question, comment, something that you want to make sure that you get in before we wrap up. We have about 24 minutes left in the broadcast.
Ivy Harris.
Greetings, Ivy.
Greetings, Gus. I don't see how it's a danger for that victim to go along with what he said, because, I mean, what is he going to do? Whip them all like slaves? He could do that anyway. That's why he said that. With impunity, he can do that. And it seems to me, as far as him, that victim, not condemning what he said, unless I missed it, no one condemned what he said. And it seems to me that if that's true, that everybody that was in there was just as scared as he was. And that's why they didn't say nothing. And that ultimately he did what he did so that he could keep himself from just that, so he could keep himself from danger. I'm not surprised that Mr. Roden, am I saying his name right, the $40 million slave offer?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm not surprised at him at all because, in my view, I haven't read the book. But to me, the title of the book comes off as opposing black people. It sounds to me, it sounds condemning. It sounds like it sounds even accusatory and dismissive of black people's jobs in athletics. That, you know, you ain't nothing but a $40 million slave. That's just, to me, the way that it comes off. And I think for him to be able to do what he does and write for the New York Times and all these different things, I just don't think that you're able to do all these things without, it's hard to say this, but without, I guess, saying things that white people want to hear. I'll put it that way. I want to say that you spoke earlier about, I don't remember what you said, but it was in line with what I'm about to say. I would say with courts and documentation and all these different things that this stuff is nothing but a production, right? So white people are just, they're just putting on a production to try to make it seem like they are into justice, even having a so-called criminal justice system, which we know is very unjust. All of that is just a production. I mean, at the end, well, let me not say that. White people practice racism. We're living on a planet dominated by racism. So anything that looks like that, even having police and all of that and all of those types of things, that's nothing but a production. That doesn't mean that they are into justice or any of these types of things that they put on. I want to say that plant-based eating is is very good in a lot of different ways, like the flavors and things like that. And it forces you to be very creative. And when you do that, I've found that you have actually more options than just, I don't know, your standard pizza or whatever it may be. And it's awesome in so many ways. You don't really have to worry about weight all that much. It's just awesome in so many ways. I wanted to ask you two questions. One, and I'll end with this. What is the lying or stealing scandal that's out there that is being called cheating? Because I don't use that term. Like, that term is just very inaccurate, and I think that term is used to downplay or to minimize things like betrayal. Like, you'll say in a relationship, you'll say cheating. No, you're not cheating. You're being unfaithful, and you're betraying people. So when we're talking about a test or academics or something like that, usually cheating on a test or something like that, that's involving lying and or stealing. So my first question is, what is this so-called cheating scandal? And two, how often would you say that you are noticeably, where you notice it, being mistreated by the white people that you come in contact with? And I'm asking you that, you know, as a black male, because for me, it's like 99.9% of the time at least. And so I was just curious about that for, you know, my male counterparts. And I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
You said the first question is, what do we mean when we say cheating? And I guess in the context of like an academic setting, what do they mean when they say cheating? Like, specifically, what does one have to do to be accused, charged, convicted of cheating in an academic sense? Is that the question?
No, what is this so-called cheating scandal that's out here? What happened?
Oh, it was basically falsifying credentials, like making up, getting falsified documents so it looked like that they were involved in sports or a part of high school clubs or groups, or had just done things that they had not done, had grades and scores that they didn't have, or had participated in activities that they actually had not, so that they could get into prestigious schools.
Oh, can I respond to that really quick?
Oh, sure.
I was just going to say, that's why I say that using that term is very inaccurate, and that usually when they say that in an academic situation, they're usually talking about lying and or stealing. In this case, it sounds like it's lying. Do you remember my second question?
How mistreated? How often are, I guess, me specifically, or black males, how often are we mistreated by white people that we know of when we are in contact with them?
Yeah, that you actually notice it, you personally, yes.
It's pretty pretty frequent. I feel like I don't always notice acts of racism like that has happened before, and I've heard that from other people as well. So, but as I notice the times that I'm at least aware of it or become aware of it pretty soon, it's pretty frequent. I wouldn't put, I haven't counted a percentage, but it's frequent enough that anytime I'm around whites, I'm on alert. They could do something, say something racist. I was at the yoga incidents. Let's see. So I was at the afternoon class today, and I'm grabbing water, towel, all little prop items that you need before class starts. White woman, suspected racist. I don't know her. I've never seen her before. She says, "Is this where you can just grab things?" And I was like, "Yep." She says, "Oh, okay. Is this the restroom right here?" It's like, "Yep." She says, "Oh, okay." And she waits, comes back. It turns out that we are close to each other, not super close. I make sure of that by my placing, so there's sufficient space. So we get to the end of class, and I have the mat wash so that I can leave promptly. I finish, and I just set it down so someone else can take it. Whatever. She grabs it and she says, "Is this yours?" I said, "Oh, it's the studio's." "So, okay." She says, "I feel like I'm asking you all these questions like you work here." Now, I pause Now, is this a moment where she's practicing racism? Am I the staff? Maybe. Maybe not. I didn't have enough discourse or conversation to even pay her enough mind to get in that. But I'm mistreated enough by whites, suspected race soldiers, that, you know, it would not surprise me if that were a deliberate act of racism. Can give you another one. So I'm at the yoga studio, Bill Cosby. I'm at the yoga studio. This is a few days previously. I'm going to change. This studio, they do have restrooms. They also have a changing area where they have like big curtains that you, like a changing room, you know, where you can go in and just change really quick. So I go in the changing room. I think it's built, as has been stated before, I'm significantly larger than pretty much everybody else that practices yoga at almost all the studios I attend, male or female. And so this was clearly designed for someone shorter than myself. So I can look over the curtain as I'm changing, even though my body is covered, but, you know, it's designed for shorter people. So I am changing. Racially ambiguous female comes in. We've taken classes together for months. And she says, "Woo, wowee, we're getting a show." Now I think, wow, let me make sure the curtain is closed. I think Bill Cosby. If this were the other way around, like, wow, the enforcement officials might have been called. Might not have been an episode of the context of white supremacy. They could have been, you know, reported in the Seattle Times that, you know, rogue Negro with, you know, crazy T-shirt and history of, you know, malicious radio content makes sexually suggestive comments at white woman in yoga studio and was, you know, assaulted by Seattle's finest. They have a monitor on the Seattle Police Department out here, just like Ferguson. So, you know, who knows where that could have went if it had been the reverse. And I also thought just the odd in at this day and time when they have sexual comments and somebody is being arrested every other day for that very type of comment. Like, wow, I just thought, like, I thought the big black male, like, you're supposed to be, you know, people are afraid of you. Negrophobia, isn't that the term that was used? That's not my experience at all. Like, I just experienced tackiness and mistreatment and accusations. And I don't have a number on it, but it's enough that I wear my shirt. That's why I wear my shirt to yoga class every time. Please treat me like I am a white person every time. I don't have a number, but it is pretty constant, if that answers the question.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I'm in my life.
Bill Cosby. Other folks that dialed in have commentary.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter. Yes, sir. Hang on 1 second. The caller at 3101. Did you have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the callers as well as the listeners. This is in Yame in Nebraska. Concerning the recent white terrorist attacks in New Zealand, I was somewhat following the story, and I noticed there was a lot of victim blaming. It was reported in the manifesto, as someone mentioned earlier, he stated, the shooter stated that he was most influenced by the non-black female, Candace Owens, who happens to repeat a lot of the speaking points of the Republican Party, as well as the U.S. President Donald Trump. But the shooter as well repeated a lot of talking points of Donald Trump. So I don't know how he could be most influenced by a victim of racism. So it seemed like he was somewhat blaming the victim there. But as a caller mentioned earlier, it could have been a way to cause confusion and kind of, throw people off. I'm not using a metaphor. I don't mean to use metaphor. Also, there was a minister in the New Zealand Parliament who tweeted and basically stated that it was the fault of people practicing Islam is why the terrorist attacks happened. He took a moment to blame victims, and it gave someone else the opportunity to call him out and condemn his words. And soon after that, the parliament introduced legislation for more gun control. And there were many people, celebrities and whatnot, in the United States who were applauding that, what they call quick response, and were saying that if only the United States would respond in a similar fashion. I'm not sure how well something like that will work here, as they never mentioned actually taking away all the weapons, just, you know, the more military-style weapons. And the last I checked, it was, you know, police and other white race soldiers mostly using pistols and shotguns. So those would still be on the streets, and we would still fall victims to that type of violence and terrorism. But I think all of these incidents are just another opportunity for white supremacists to further refine the system of white supremacy. And right here on another note, right here in Nebraska, they're experiencing what they call the most historic floods, worst floods in 50 years. Several small towns, smaller towns than the ones I'm in, are flooded. There's a lot of high waters. There's been some deaths. There's been a lot of damage going on. Several towns, but I've been to quite a few of those towns, and I could tell you that majority of the people in those towns are white people. And right here where we are, it's not as bad, but I've been to a lot of those towns, and you speaking about sundown towns in the book club, and many of those towns that I've been to just growing up around here, the moment you be in town and it's dark, you know, you get confronted by suspected race soldiers who try to start a conflict with you. Sometimes a few of my friends were assaulted a few times in those towns. Just traveling through the towns a couple of times, I've been followed by policy enforcers going the opposite direction. They look over into the car, see a black male. They turn around and follow you. Hopefully you make a mistake, they could pull you over. Otherwise, they follow you all the way to the lines of their jurisdiction and continue to roll around. So while the loss of life is nothing to celebrate, I don't feel too bad about the racist white supremacists around here. But with that, I'll mute my line. Thanks for letting me share.
Much obliged. Thank you for sharing. Our caller in Nebraska. Wow. I think the suspected race soldiers in Nebraska, who are suffering the floods, they will be all right. The system of white supremacy. If I can quote the great American classic, system of white supremacy has their back. We heard the report last week. When there are disasters, white people tend to come out better than non-white people. So I'm sure other whites will have their back. Retired firefighter, thank you for your patience, sir.
Yes, greetings. I'm not surprised about your report on Mr. Roden specifically. I don't know him personally, but I would say he does have a level of national notoriety, and I would say that in that position, a non-white person probably would be either reluctant to speak on racism in a scientific direct form, or either have an uncomfortable laughter, as you stated, an uncomfortable form of laughter, or it's kind of funny. And normally in that case, the non-white person in the situation is going to suffer the brunt of the chuckles. I put it that way. The what was I thought was
pretty good with the book itself was the detail that he described in the book of a history of non-white black people in this part of the world, their involvement in sports entertainment that's normally is not reported on. And he gave in that case, he did give a scientific understanding of the demise in those activities, such as Negro League Baseball. That's what it was called. I didn't name it. Negro League Baseball. The instance where Mr. Michael Jordan, first assumed that the white owner of the NBA basketball team was going to share partnership with him, and he was basically brought into reality that this white male was not going to share his fortune with a Negro, and there was also the effort that took place between, it was a famous game of two HCBU colleges in New York City, Yankee Stadium to be exact, Morris Brown versus Grambling, that took place where a large amount of money was raised. Just some of the incidents that took place in this book that he described as normally you wouldn't see in any book. $40 million slave, I just take that as a reality. Whether he was name calling, I'm not sure of that as far as that concerned, but money does not determine on whether or not a non-white black person has overcame the system of racist white supremacy. That's basically what the title described to me. And I still would recommend to anyone who wants to inform themselves about the sports entertainment history in this part of the world, that book has to be on your list. That would be my recommendation on it. That book would have to be on your list if you are interested in wanting to find out about the non-white black people's history in the people activity of sports entertainment. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. I have not read that book, so we'll have to perhaps the book club, where I'll check it out in advance and see Mr. Roden, victim of white supremacy. With that, incidentally, Mr. Roden, he had Walter Beach III as a guest on his broadcast. Walter Beach III quoted Mr. Fuller, "If you don't understand racism, white supremacy," and then Bill Roden said the quote again a week or two later on the air. But it is a lot more to it in terms of understanding what racism is and how it works. Anywho, that is our 3 hours. We will be back. I think we will be here on Wednesday. I'll have to report back with all of the details and information, but I think it should be this coming Wednesday. And then we'll have the book club, James Lowen, Sundown Towns, already mentioned. That'll be Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Workplace Racism, already mentioned. Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If you have questions, inquiries about the California July 3rd through July 7th Cows Yoga Retreat, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. If you have guest suggestions, gripes, complaints, feel free, drop an email. I will report back promptly. Again, the memorial for Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, if you're in the D.C. area, that is Sunday, March 17, 4 p.m. Eastern, at the Thurgood Marshall Center, 1816 12th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C. I'll post the information again on Facebook, Twitter, all that good stuff, and you can check it out if you're in the D.C. area. Pay your respects. Demonstrate Dr. Welsing's significance. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Race soldiers do a lot to abuse and terrorize us already. Let's make sure that we are at least thinking correctly so that we can do all that we can to keep ourselves safe. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.